I'd like to convene the meeting. We have an ambitious agenda here this morning, and those of you that are still getting some of the amendments could just quietly pick them up. We'll try to get started. We did have some amendments that came in this morning, so the staff has done a good job of getting those added to the packets. So that's why you're just now able to pick them up. A couple of things by way of information for committee members. We have a rather ambitious agenda this morning. Originally, when we set the agenda, the House session was going to start at 12:30. They've moved that to 11:30, so that makes our time frame a little bit tighter, so I'm not sure we'll get through the entire agenda, but we'll get as far as we can, and any agenda items that remain will be laid over until after the spring break. On the three omnibus bills that are before us here this morning, the authors are going to present them. We'll take any amendments to those bills, and then we're going to lay them over until after the spring break. The reason is that we are very close, but there may be a few issues that remain in terms of aligning the accounts up with the Senate. And so what we will be doing after the spring break with these three bills and the others is doing what is part of this committee's responsibility, that of aligning the accounts with the Senate. So after, for example, Representative Yaros is done, and I understand there are some amendments that will be proposed to the bill, after we've disposed of the amendments, then we will simply lay that bill over until after spring break. We do have the minutes in the packets, and I noticed Representative Houseman has been particularly attentive. Would you like to move the amendments?
Minutes.
Representative Houseman moves the approval of the amendments.
Minutes,
excuse me. For March 26th, any discussion on the minutes? Hearing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Representative Yaros, if you could begin presenting the Minnesota Heritage Finance Division bill.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members. I move the Minnesota Heritage Finance Division report for House File 1660, First Committee Engrossment.
That motion is before us. Any discussion? Hearing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Representative Yaros.
Now, Mr. Chairman and members, the bill is simple but very important for our heritage in Minnesota. We're going to be celebrating 150th birthday of our state next year, and there's some money in the bill for that. What we did was we just took everything that the governor recommended, and except for administrative costs for the sesquicentennial, I don't know. I still think it should be something else. Sesquicentennial. Ses, it means six. We're not celebrating 600 years anyway. But and I used to study Latin and. Anyway, 150th birthday. We thought that 25% for administrative costs was too excessive, and we cut it down to about a little more than 10%. Explore Minnesota budget has an additional $3 million. And the governor has recommended $1 million for Snowbait, the Minnesota Film and TV Board. They promote and try to attract as many films to be made in Minnesota as possible, a very cost-effective program. For the Historical Society, and this was mostly Representative Erdahl's bill, We have put in addition to what the governor recommended, $1.5 million for local grants. That area has been cut severely since the budget problems of 2003, and $500,000 for historic buildings. The Historical Society tour reimbursement, remember, tours were fees were imposed for the students and others that come to our capital, and we wiped that out and gave the Historical Society $120,000 so they don't have to charge fees. There also is a Concordia Hmong Studies Center Historical Preservation grant of $200,000. St. Louis County, the Nicollet County grant, and I think that's about it of one-time extra money. We gave the Arts Board $1,750,000 in addition to what the governor recommended. He recommended $1 million also. We reestablished the funding of the Humanities Commission. Remember, in 2003, it was the state funding was cut off altogether, and we are giving them $500,000 a year. They used to get $1 million a year. Public TV, $1.3 million. Amateur sports, $322,000. And Science Museum and the zoo, $500,000 each of one-time money. There also is in the Minority Council's Indian Affairs Council, Rosa Eakins Becker County Native American burial ground that they want to purchase in Becker County. Also, there is a $100,000 appropriation to go to the higher education to save the indigenous languages in Minnesota. I think the public radio also. Public radio is getting 996 in addition to what they are getting already. There are only two tales for the next biennium, and that is Historical Society Tours reimbursement and Humanities Commission. Hopefully will be continued in the next biennium following this one. Any questions?
Here, okay, and that's the overview then of the bill. We do have some amendments, Representative Yarros. Are any of them author's amendments?
No.
Okay, so
Mr. Chair,
we will take questions, and then we'll move to the amendments in a moment. Representative Coles.
Mr. Chair, Representative Yarros, could you just give us, I looked at the spreadsheet quickly. I got so much paper here in front of me. Help me understand where you're at compared to the governor's recommendation, both in 08, 09, and 10 and 11, please.
Mr. Chair, Representative Coles, the governor's recommendation is about $9.8 million. Less. We're using $9.8 million of one-time money to make up some of the lost funding in the last 3-4 years.
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Yarros, the additional money over the governor's recommendation is one-time money. It's from the billion-dollar one-time surplus. Is that correct? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Are there other questions of Representative Yarros? Okay, seeing none, we do have, as I mentioned earlier, some amendments. The first one we have is H-166-ODE-2. And I'm not sure there wasn't a name on the amendment. It looks like it may be a fairly significant one. DE2 are the last. What is it? Apparently, this one, DE2, is withdrawn.
Mr. Chairman, I'll offer.
Hey, Representative Swingham moves DE2.
I don't know whose amendment it is, but looking through it very, very quickly and looking through the spreadsheet.
Representative Swingham, one of your staff people approached me and said you would not be offering all of the amendments. So is this one that you're going to offer? I just want to make sure you've got all the signals straight on it.
Mr. Chairman, I have my signal straight.
Okay.
If I offered the amendment, that's pretty straight signal.
Yeah, it was just that, I just was told that you may not be offering
any. It's not steal, it's not bunt, it's not hit and run.
And the way you approached, you said, well, I would offer it. It was sort of like I thought maybe you were.
No, Mr. Chairman, I'll offer the amendment.
Okay. Representative Swingham moves the amendment. Any if you'd like to explain the amendment, Representative Swingham.
Mr. Chairman, taking off on the first question that Representative Poles asked Mr. Garros, this bill is approximately $10 million, members, over the governor's recommendation. I would make the argument to you as this bill and the other bills, the Health and Human Services, the welfare bills that are coming forward, that are creating within this session the need to of some to raise taxes, even though we have $3 billion of additional money available and about 9.8% money to spend. When you start adding up the bills, $10 million here, $100 million there, $200 million there, we get to the point of coercing tax increases in the legislature. It's just simply not going to happen. Members, the amendment I have before you is Governor Pawlenty's recommendation for this entire Heritage Finance Committee. It's the entire recommendation for the numbers, including Explore Minnesota, the Historical Society, the Board of Arts, the Amateur Sports Commission, and the various councils. This amendment will live within the means that the state has. It will live within the governor's recommendation. It is $10 million less than Representative Jarros's bill we have before us. But offering this amendment, plus the others we will offer, will make sure that we don't get coerced into tax increases in this legislative session when we have $3 billion of additional money available. So, Mr. Chairman, I will offer the amendment.
Okay, the amendment is before us. Any discussion? Representative Jarros?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Swingham, we took the governor's proposal and put in one-time money. It's an investment. Tourism, historical society, history, and environment are really popular tourism attractions for Minnesota. And this investment, and of course the film board and amateur sports, these investments that we're making with one-time money is going to attract private money, and it's going to bring in tourists, and you know that's a big income for to the state of Minnesota, not only taxes but also to the private sector renting out motels and hotels and using restaurants and so on.
And Representative Jarros, when I look at the spreadsheet, and others may have already, you're within the target as set by the House Budget Resolution, the Ways and Means Committee. So any further discussion on the amendment? Representative Haymark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a question for Representative Swingham. Representative Swingham, you mentioned this $3 billion surplus. I'm just curious. I heard about the $2 billion, and then most of us know that that's only $1 billion when you take inflation into account. But where did this $3 billion come to? Did that happen sometime over the weekend where I wasn't paying attention? But I'm just trying to get how the surplus grew that large.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Paymire, $1 billion is automatically built into the budget from last year to this biennium. If this legislature were to do nothing and go home, not do a thing, the budget's going to be $1 billion more. That's to increase growth of caseloads in MFEP, medical assistance, new students, automatically built into law. So that's the $1 billion on top of the 2.2. Simple math says that's $3 billion of additional spending. Mr. Chairman, I move the amendment. I would ask for a roll call vote, Mr. Chairman. This is the first of many bills that will be going through this. Well, I guess the deficiency bill may have been the first one, which is still spending itself $2 million more than what the governor recommended. Mr. Chairman, I do not plan to invest Minnesota in such a way that we force a tax increase.
If you could just slow down a moment. Representative Paymer, are you asking to yield for a question?
I thought I answered the question.
He did.
Okay. Representative Swigum.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I thought I answered the question. So I thought you wanted to move.
Beyond that, but now you are. So continue your speech if you'd like.
Well, thank you. Mr. Chairman, I thought you wanted to move along quickly this morning. We'll make it as fast or as slow as
you
want.
Go ahead.
We do not plan to invest our way to a tax increase here in Minnesota, folks. The governor and I will not let it happen. We didn't manage the budget well over the past few years to invest ourselves to a surplus and then a tax increase on top of it. I would appreciate your vote on this. Mr. Chairman, the amendment again puts the governor's numbers, recommended numbers, into this bill, short the $10 million that the majority has added. Whether it's within the target or not, Mr. Chairman, really makes no difference to myself and many of the minority members. It's the targets that blow the priorities of the state of Minnesota.
Any further discussion? Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, just a gentle correction, Representative Swigum. We can't go home without doing anything. If we go home without doing anything, there are no appropriations to run state government. So we don't, that's not an option. And I also noticed in your delete everything amendment, you were very ungentle to the very good work that Representative Yaros did, because it's a delete everything amendment. So you omitted, for example, in the Indian Affairs Council, the acquisition of an Indian burial site, the acquisition of the Dakota Ojibwe Language Revitalization Program. I just think that this is just a crude cleaver that makes believe there was no need for the legislature to meet this entire year.
Representative Coles.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kahn, I have an amendment on those issues a little later that we can talk about as talk about the various earmarks that exist in Representative Yaros' bill. But Representative Yaros, you talked about it's a good investment. It's a good investment, and that may or may not be true. But I got over the weekend a new document. It's the Official Democrat Dictionary, a guide for proper interpretation in the Minnesota Legislature, Seifert's abridged edition, 2007. And I turned to investment. It's on the fourth page, and it says, number one, a tax increase, or number two, spending more money on government programs regardless of their necessity or effectiveness. So I just want Minnesotans to know that as we talk about investment around here, we're talking about spending, we're talking about tax increases, Representative Swigum, I thank you for bringing forward the amendment, and I look forward to supporting it.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And before I vote on this amendment, perhaps we could get back to Representative Kahn's question. I see, Representative Yaros, that the governor had recommended for the Indian Affairs Council $481,000 and then $487,000 for the biennium. And it looks to me that you've basically doubled that for an additional $580,000. And I'm looking at some of the other councils that you stayed in line with the governor's recommendation. I'm wondering why you feel that the Indian Affairs Council should get approximately $600,000 more than some of the other councils.
Now, Mr. Chairman, Representative Pepin, I did not change that at all. That's the governor's recommendation. That's the base funding. They're getting $481,000 this coming year and $487,000, next biennium. And then the governor added, let's see, the governor added some compensation adjustment, which is very small. So I'm just keeping, this is what the governor recommended.
Thank you.
Representative Solberg.
Mr. Chair, just a couple of points of corrections, and not about to get into a difficulty, but I do want to correct a couple of things, Representative Swigum, and that is the management has, in the last few years, has managed to increase tuition a great deal and increase property taxes a huge amount. And then one other correction, that the governor's efficiency bill is $240,000 higher than the governor's recommendation, and that's not $2 million, and that is the court reimbursement. An update on that.
Representative Sertich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Coles. It's good to see that you spent your weekend doing something productive, trying to be creative with a new dictionary. Maybe it would have been more productive if you guys came out with your own plan. It was always fun to be in the minority and say, where's your plan, Democrats, where's your plan? Yeah, and you can hold up the governor's budget, and that's all well and good. It's interesting, the minority party, when the governor says jump, you guys say how high. We're not here to be a rubber stamp for the governor and his budget. We're here to lead and do our own work. So instead of being lemmings jumping off a cliff, I'm going to vote no.
Any further
Chairman?
Discussion? Representative Seifert.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Swigum's amendment gives our plan out here. Now, we're going to agree with the governor on a lot of things. We're not going to agree with on everything, but Representative Sertich, we're offering in good faith a way to stay within the budget constraints so you don't have to have the highest tax rates in the country. And what I'm hearing from my constituents over the weekend is they're not interested in the tax increase schemes that your caucus is putting forward and that the Senate's putting forward. Now, you can ram all these bills through that have these gigantic spending increases, but the people of Minnesota aren't interested in it. So we can work together now with the governor to bring everything back to normal, still have spending growth, still have government grow, still have the programs that some maybe are necessary and some aren't. But you look at some of the appropriations in here, I can see why someone from St. Louis County might like the bill. It's got $150,000 for a one-time grant to St. Louis County for a feasibility study and planning activities concerning additional uses for the St. Louis County Heritage and Arts Center at the Duluth Depot. Now, where I come from, that may not be necessary. And you add those types of earmarks over and over and over again. Where are the fiscal moderates? Where are the centrists that were supposedly going to be running the show? Nowhere to be found. We found lots of tax increasers. We found lots of spenders, but we didn't find a whole lot in the way of the fiscal moderates we were talking about last fall. So you can vote this amendment down, but we don't want to hear people say we didn't have a plan, because we do have a plan. We had our budget targets. We offered them in Ways and Means. Representative Emmer brought them and made a big presentation. We didn't have one question from the DFL. Not one. We unveiled targets. We unveiled some ideas in press conferences. But more importantly, Representative Emmer did unveil our budget targets. We are offering amendments. And we'll just have to offer specific amendments to try to hone in on perhaps what the needs and the wants are and make the difference. But I can tell you one thing. If this is how all the budget bills are going to go, we're going to be here a long time accusing us of not having plans when we're offering amendments. We're trying to offer our positive ideas here. We just want to make sure that we're given some due consideration without people saying, casting dispersions, that we're just rubber stamps for the governor. We believe that some of these priorities are very good. Some of these things are nice, but they're not necessary for what government's doing. So I'd really urge members to give this consideration, especially if you consider yourself a fiscal moderate or a fiscal conservative or a fiscal centrist, whatever that might be.
Okay, we have two people that have requested to be recognized, and then I think we'll hear from the author, and then we'll take a vote on the amendment. Representative Sertich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Seifert. I never said you had a plan, just said you're a rubber stamping for the governor here. You talk about going back to normal. I want to highlight and maybe talk a bit more what Representative Solberg said and put more into context. Back to normal. when you guys were in charge, meant tuition doubled. Back to normal meant fees were increased by almost $1 billion more, property taxes by $2 billion more. And the most forgotten about tax, I mean, I hear you guys say all the time, solve that $4.5 billion deficit without raising taxes. Folks forget about the cigarette tax. I'm sorry. Cigarette fee of almost $1.5 billion. Members, if we're going to rubber stamp the governor's budget, it'll cost property taxes, and this isn't my opinion, this is research done, it'll cost property taxpayers another $1.5 billion. Back to normal seems like the wrong direction for Minnesota taxpayers. I'd encourage a no vote.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I spent my whole weekend, you know, at the grocery store and at the hardware store and every place else and close by a phone. And the six or seven people that our property tax relief, tax increase would cause, I had two people call me that make over $250,000 in my district, and they both thought it was a great idea to put money into education and property tax relief. So I think this is a foolish way to go back to the governor's budget, and I'm glad that the majority leader brought forth all the fees and tax increases that we had over the last 4 years. And I think a no vote is a good vote on this particular amendment.
Thank you, Representative Yaros.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, President Seifert, the St. Louis County, actually, this should be the last portion of that paragraph says that the study would include the railroad, passenger railroad service between St. Louis County and Duluth, St. Louis County, and Twin Cities. I think that probably a lot more was spent on other railroad studies. I am not a moderate, I'm a liberal, but fiscally responsible. We did not spend any more than what we have in the committee.
Mr. Chairman, I'm the author of the amendment, though.
Hey, Representative Swigum.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I thought when you said to the author last, I thought you meant the author of the amendment.
Of the bill, but that's fine. You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, the amendment before you allows Minnesota to live within its means. It allows us to live within the $3 billion that we have for this biennium over the last biennium. And yes, I would be proud, Representative Surge. I am proud. If you want to call me a water boy for the governor or just bringing the governor's recommendations forward, I am honored. I am honored to do that, without question. I will stand with the governor and his recommendations, his management of the state of Minnesota. I'll stand with him shoulder to shoulder. What, in fact, has happened, Mr. Chairman, is that Representative Surge, you talk about property tax increases. In fact, with the 2001 property tax reform that the Governor Pawlenty and the majority of the last 4 years came by, we brought significant billions of property tax relief to Minnesotans. By taking over the cost of education, by taking over the transit levy, we have brought billions of property tax relief that normally would have been there in the budget if we wouldn't have stood by that property tax relief that came forward. Mr. Chairman, the amendment before us very simply lives within the governor's recommendations, the targets that the governor set to make sure that we do not bring forward any tax increases this session upon the citizens of Minnesota that will kill growth and jobs.
Representative Grayling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Very quickly, I know you want to get to a vote, but Representative Swigum, I just couldn't let you say that we have property tax relief because the state took over education funding. That was Governor Ventura's good plan, but as you know, all these property tax increases that we foisted off on the schools and their reliance on levy referendums that they can't even pass now because of the property tax increases from cities and counties and schools have been eroded, so we're back where we started from and then some.
Yeah, I think we'll take the vote.
Carlson?
No.
Anderson?
Yes.
Clark? Cornish?
Aye.
Earhart, Finstead, Groffalo, Grayling,
no.
Hackbarth,
aye.
Hausman,
no.
Hilty,
no.
Howes,
yeah.
Huntley, Yaros,
no.
Junkie,
no.
Kahn,
no.
Coles,
yes.
Mancheski,
no.
Leader, Mahoney,
no.
Mariani?
No.
Murphy? Otrimba?
No.
Pamar?
No.
Pelosi?
No.
Pepin?
Yeah.
Poppy?
No.
Rukavina?
No.
Sailor?
No.
Seifert?
Yes.
Sertich?
No.
Severson? Simon?
No.
Flawick?
No.
Solberg?
No.
Swigum?
Yes.
Thiessen?
No.
Boginius?
No.
Walker? Westrom? Earhart? Finstead? Garofalo? Hunsley? Leader? Murphy? Severson? Walker? Westrom?
The motion fails 22-8. We have another amendment here, A13.
How many amendments have we had so far?
Representative Swigum, we... the amendments were submitted without any names, but I am told they all originally came from the minority. But as I mentioned to you earlier, I was told that you may or may not choose to offer all of them. So A13, as the lead Republican, is that one you're going to move then, or just hold it?
Actually, being the lead Republican means absolutely nothing here, as you know, but I'll pull the amendment.
How about A12?
No, let's pull that one too, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, and A11?
That's my
I heard a voice. It was Representative Coles. Okay, Representative Coles moves amendment H1660A11. Representative Coles.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members, one of the things that I'm concerned about with this bill is that it contains several earmarks, things that I don't think are necessary in the bill, and I'm concerned about them. Mr. Chair, members, what the A11 amendment does is it removes the earmark for Nicollet County and puts that money back into the grant and aid program for local historical societies. There's absolutely no reason, Mr. Chair, why we should be running around doing earmarks in a bill like this. I think it's inappropriate, and I'd stand for questions, Mr. Chair. That's the amendment. The money does stay in the bill. I should note it stays in the bill. The $150,000 for Nicollet County is moved back into the county grant and aid program.
Okay, any discussion on the Coles amendment? Representative Yaros?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman. Representative Coles, the reason that Nicollet and St. Louis counties are in, I thought, that because they were governmental units, that's the way it had to be. We do also have Representative Gunther's, Representative Cornish's museums, Winnebago and Wells museums, and Representative Dabney's St. Anthony Falls. Well, they're nonprofit, not connected with the county or governmental units, so they didn't need to be listed.
Any further discussion? Hearing none, then, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
And opposed?
No.
Okay, noes have it. Motion defeated. Now we have A10.
Mr. Chair, I'll move that one.
Okay. Representative Seifert moves H1660A10. Representative Seifert, if you want to explain it.
Mr. Chair, this simply takes out the earmark for the St. Louis County project that Representative Yaros and I already discussed. We do not put the money back in anywhere. I think that money can fall to the bottom line, so piece by piece and line item by line item. We can build ourselves back to fiscal sanity. and not have all of the particular spending that goes above and beyond the governor's recommendations. The governor recommends a certain amount of spending, and if we go above and beyond that over and over again, we are going to force ourselves into a tax increase. I know that's what the Democrats want to do, but there are people in the state of Minnesota who would like us to live within our means, to live within what the governor's recommended. And I think this is important enough that I'd ask for a roll call on this one, Mr. Chair.
A roll call has been requested, and Representative Yaros, care to comment?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Seifert, as I said, this is more than just the St. Louis County Depot. It is a study of a possible train, passenger train between Duluth and Rush City. I guess St. Paul is doing it. St. Paul is doing it, or Ramsey County to Rush City. So we want to connect those plans. That's what it is.
Any further discussion? Roll call having been requested, clerk, take the roll.
Carlson?
No.
Anderson?
Yes.
Clark? Cornish?
Aye.
Earhart? Finstead? Garofalo? Greiling?
No.
Hackbarth?
Aye.
Hausman?
No.
Hilty?
No.
Howes?
Yes.
Huntley? Yaros?
No.
Junkie?
Yeah. No.
Kahn?
No.
Coles?
Yes.
Manchesky?
No.
Leader? Mahoney?
No.
Mariani?
No.
Murphy? Otremba? Hebar?
No.
Kolowski?
No.
Pepin?
Yes.
Poppy?
No.
Rukavina?
Got it.
It's Duluth. No.
Sailor?
No.
Seifert?
Yes.
Sertich?
No.
Severson?
Yes.
Simon?
No.
Slawit?
No.
Solberg?
No.
Swigum?
Yep.
Thiessen?
No.
Wagenius?
No.
Walker? Westrom?
Motion defeated 22-9. We now have A9.
Mr. Chair, if I could offer the A9.
Representative Cole moves H1660A9. That motion is before us. Representative Coles.
Actually, Mr. Chair, I'd like to. My preference, Mr. Chair, I apologize. I'd prefer to offer the A8 first.
Okay, I'm just taking him in the order that.
If I could, Mr. Chair, I'd like to temporarily.
So that's fine with me.
I'd like to offer the A8 first.
Okay, Representative Coles withdraws the motion to offer A9 and instead moves H1660A8. So that motion is before us. Is this one withdrawn then? Is
no,
going to offer
Mr.
it?
No, I suspect I'm going to offer it.
Okay.
We'll see. We'll see what happens here, Mr. Chair. If my amendment goes on, then I probably won't offer it. So maybe
okay.
Just one vote instead of three, Mr.
You're
Chair.
Optimistic. Okay.
I'm hoping, Mr. Chair, members. There's some language in this bill that gives me a little bit of pause, and the A8 amendment is a measure of accountability, fiscal responsibility. What the bill does in its current form is it basically allows the Minnesota Historical Society to reallocate funds without any oversight of the legislature at all. The amendment, the A8 amendment, would require that any time a transfer in excess of $10,000 occurs, that the Historical Society notify the chairs of the standing committees of the House and the Senate with jurisdiction over its budget. Members, this is all about fiscal responsibility, fiscal accountability. I urge your support.
And Representative Yaros?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Coles, I don't know. This is my first time dealing with this budget. Have there been any problems, or do you know of any problems that the Historical Society has caused with this transfer of money?
Representative Coles.
Mr. Chair, Representative Yalas, I can't point to anything specifically, but I am aware of problems that the legislative auditor identified in our grant programs and other areas where we are providing money to other organizations. We as a legislature have a responsibility to the citizens of the state of Minnesota to make sure that the money we are appropriating is spent wisely, is spent appropriately. And this amendment doesn't prohibit them from doing those transfers. It just requires them to identify to the legislature when those transfers occur so that we can understand what the Historical Society is doing with their budget next time they come back 2 years from now, presumably, looking for additional state dollars to help run their operations.
Representative Yarros.
Oh, sure. Perhaps if there is a problem, maybe we could do this later if there is a need for it. I haven't heard of any problems.
Okay, Representative Penn.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Coles, I carried the bill for the grant oversight with very good bipartisan authorization. In fact, it was in the governor's recommendation in the state government finance bill. And I don't remember, I read the report pretty thoroughly, I don't remember any reference to Historical Society grants. It was much more the large grants that went really to organizations out of the state. And in addition, with the oversight that we've put into that in that new legislation, which you'll get a chance to see when the state government finance bill comes along, I don't think that this is necessary. And I think the additional paperwork that you're looking at is just outrageous.
Mr. Chair, just very, very briefly, Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, I appreciate that, and I'm not aware of a specific instance with the Historical Society either. I just don't think we should wait for a problem to happen before we address it.
Mr. Chairman, I've said we're not. We have put in the coming state government finance bill, which I'm hoping you'll support.
That's great optimism, Representative Kahn.
Very specific requirements for much more detailed oversight than you want, than you're asking for. So you'll have your chance to vote for that.
Any more discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor of the amendment A8 signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
No.
The motion is defeated. Did you want to take up your A9 now?
The A7, Mr. Chair.
Or A7 next, okay.
Mr. Chair, members, the A7 is the same thing, except it moves the, and I move the A7, Mr. Chair, it moves the number from $10,000 to $100,000. We need to understand what quasi-state agencies are doing with the money that we are providing to them. Mr. Chair, members, it's just simply a measure of accountability and responsibility. I urge your support. And I would ask for a roll call on this one, Mr. Chair.
Roll call has been requested. Representative Yarrow.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Cole, as I said before, if you find some problems, then we could do this later, but I haven't heard of anything.
Any further discussion? Representative House.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Coles, do we do this with other agencies?
Representative Coles.
Mr. Chair, Representative House, we certainly do it with state agencies. We have line-by-line budgets that the finance divisions consider and this committee ultimately considers. I think that as a matter of and whether we do it enough, probably not. I think we ought to keep a better handle on the state's purse and state's checkbook and make sure that the money that we are appropriating either directly to state agencies or to, I'm going to call the Historical Society, it's probably not the correct term, but a quasi-state agency, an agency that receives most of its appropriations from the state of Minnesota, we ought to insist upon some fiscal accountability and responsibility. And again, I'm not aware of anything specific. I'm not accusing the Historical Society of any improprieties with their budget, but it's their budget that's before us right now. And so that's why the amendment's here, Representative Housing members.
Okay, any further discussion? Roll call was requested, so clerk will take the roll.
Carlson?
No.
Anderson?
Yes.
Clark? Cornish?
Yes.
Gerhardt? Finstead? Garofalo? Dreiling?
No.
Hackbarth? Hausman?
No.
Hilty?
No.
House?
No.
Huntley?
No.
Yaros?
No.
Shunkey?
No.
Kahn?
No.
Coles?
Yes.
Manchesky?
No.
Leader? Mahoney?
No.
Mariani?
No.
Murphy? Otremba?
No.
Hamer?
No.
Kowalski? Pepin?
Yes.
Poppy?
Yes.
Bukovina?
No.
Sailor?
No.
Seifert?
Yes.
Sturdich?
No.
Severson? Simon?
Yes.
Slawick?
No.
Solberg?
No.
Swigum?
Yes.
Thiessen?
No.
Wagenius?
No.
Walker? Westrum?
Yes.
Quote no.
For your daughters.
Chair, I'll vote yes. Finstead votes yes, being 22 no's and 10 yeses, motion defeated. We've got A6 here.
A9, Mr. Chair. I'm going to withdraw the A9 amendment. I think it's unfortunate that we can't ask for some fiscal accountability, and when we're appropriating large sums of money, the A9 would have required the same thing if there was a transfer of more than $1 million. But I can see where this is going, Mr. Chair. I'm concerned that we're not concerned as a committee, as a legislature, about fiscal responsibility and accountability. I'm going to withdraw it at this time, Mr. Chair.
Okay, we have still in our packets then A6.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, I was wondering if the majority leader or Representative Sturdich or Representative Slawick, who sat on the committee that had jurisdiction of the Historical Society with me for the last 6 years, remembers any kind of oversight attempt like this when the Republicans had this particular committee or oversight in jobs and economic development, or when Representative Swigum was Speaker. Could Majority Leader or Representative Slawick answer you to that question?
Representative Sturdich.
Representative Mahoney, I actually staffed this committee in the Senate when the Republicans were in charge. So the last 10 years, the answer is no. Didn't care about it then.
Oh, okay. So it's okay. When they're in charge, they don't need any oversight. But all right. Thank you.
Okay, we have A6. Is there anyone that's going to be moving that amendment?
Mr. Chairman, I think we'll withdraw that amendment.
Withdraw that one. Okay, Representative Swigum. And then there's an A15 amendment.
Mr. Chairman, I like to lose, I guess. I'm a glutton for punishment. I'll offer the A15 amendment. Mr. Chair, members, what the A15 amendment does is deletes the two earmarks that exist on page 11. Representative Kahn mentioned these earlier. I'm looking for them right now, Mr. Chair, in the bill. They're the two earmarks under the Indian Affairs Council, Mr. Chair. Those may or may not be good projects, Mr. Chair. I'm not moving the amendment to say that they are or are not good projects. But, Mr. Chair, I heard a lot of concern about Bridges to Nowhere and other earmarks during the campaign this past fall. I know members on both sides of the aisle, not just at the federal level, but talked about that and talked about fiscal accountability and responsibility at the state level as well. And putting earmarks like this in the bill, I think, are unnecessary. It's inappropriate, and I would urge members' support, and I would ask for a roll call.
Okay, roll call has been requested, and Representative Yaros.
Yes, Chairman. Representative Cole, again, we didn't spend any more than we had. We didn't borrow any or bond for anything.
Mr. Chair.
Representative
Coles. Mr. Chair, Representative Yaros, I understand that. That's not the point. The point is that the Indian Affairs Council can make those appropriations if the Indian Affairs Council deems them to be appropriate. We shouldn't be doing this kind of earmarking. In fact, I just had a couple amendments that would have asked for some reporting some accountability, some after the fact accountability, and that was we said no to that apparently. But so here now in the bill we're saying, well, you got to go spend money on this when I was just told we shouldn't be doing that kind of micromanaging apparently. And so I guess for consistency's sake, I hope that members who voted against me on the previous amendments will support me now. But not just for consistency's sake, for the fact that we shouldn't be doing earmarks like this. This isn't the bonding bill. You're right, Representative Yaros. We're not identifying specific projects. We're providing funding to the Indian Affairs Council. If these are good projects, let's let the Indian Affairs Council fund them with the appropriation we're providing.
Okay, any further discussion? Roll call was requested. Clerk will begin the roll.
Carlson?
No.
Anderson?
Yes.
Clark? Cornish?
Aye.
Earhart? Binstead?
Yes.
Groffel? Greiling?
No.
Ackbarth? Hausman?
No.
Hilty?
No.
House?
No.
Huntley?
No.
Yaros?
No.
Junkie?
No.
Kahn?
No.
Coles?
Yes.
Lencheski? No. Leader? Mahoney?
No.
Mariani?
No.
Murphy? Otrimba?
No.
Hamer?
No.
Kalowski?
No.
Pepin?
Yes.
Poppy?
No.
Rukavina? Sailor?
No.
Seifert?
Yes.
Thurditch?
No.
Severson?
Yes.
Simon?
No.
Flawick?
No.
Solberg?
No.
Swigum?
Yes.
Thiessen?
No.
Wagenius?
No.
Walker? Westrom?
Yes.
Heckler, look here.
There being 23 no's and 10 yeses, motion is defeated. Okay, well, we have one more. You might have another option.
Well, I'm not going to offer it.
Oh, that's not. Yours isn't the next one. Okay, we have an A14 offered by someone. Representative Pepin.
I'm out of that one.
Okay.
This, what this amendment would do, it would take the.
This one is just being passed out, so but why don't you go ahead and explain it, Representative Pepin.
Sure. Well, I see a problem with both what the governor offered and what's in the bill. There are four councils, councils on Black Minnesotans, council on Chicano Latino Affairs, council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans, and the Indian Affairs Council. As I pointed out before, the Indian Affairs Council is slotted for $500,000 to $600,000 more than any of the other councils. The other councils are all about equal, and this amendment would simply take the same amount of money and equalize the distribution amongst the four different councils. I think that's fair. I think that we shouldn't pick a preference of one over the other, and I would urge a roll call on this important amendment.
Okay, roll call has been requested. Representative Yaros?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman and Representative Pepin. As I said earlier, I have not done anything changed. The committee hasn't changed anything. It is as the governor recommended it. I don't know why the Indian Affairs Council gets more than the others. I assume perhaps it is because they have an office here and an office on the reservation.
Okay, the motion is before us. Any further discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Huntley. I just want Majority Leader, Mr. Yaros, I just want to point out to Majority Leader Sirkic that I am not a rubber stamp for the governor. Please let that be noted, and I don't agree with the governor's recommendations on this. I think it's very unfair that one council would get more, and that does include the $180,000 in earmarks, which I believe are wrong, and I would urge member support.
Okay, the clerk will take the roll.
Carlson?
No.
Anderson?
Yes.
Clark? Cornish?
Aye.
Earhart? Binstead?
Yes.
Groffel? Greiling?
No.
Hackbarth?
Aye.
Hausman?
No.
Hilty?
No.
House?
No.
Huntley?
No.
Yaros?
No.
Junkie? Kahn?
No.
Coles?
Yes.
Lincheski?
No.
Leader? Mahoney?
No.
Mariani?
No.
Murphy? Otremba?
No.
Paymar?
No.
Pulowski?
No.
Pepin?
Yes.
Poppy?
No.
Rukavina?
No.
Sailor?
No.
Seifert?
Yes.
Sertich?
No.
Severson?
Yes.
Simon?
No.
Slavik?
No.
Solberg?
No.
Swigum?
Yes.
Thiessen?
No.
Wagenius?
No.
Wagenius?
No.
I'm sorry. Walker? Westrom?
Yes.
Okay, the motion is defeated 23-10. Are there any amendments to be offered to House File, let's see, 1660? Representative Seifert?
Mr. Chair, I don't know that I have an amendment, but I have a question on page 10. And if Representative Yaros could answer this or someone else, we heard a little bit before about the Republicans didn't want accountability. When I was chair of state government finance, we had jurisdiction over Minnesota Public Radio, and we see there's $475,000 in the first year and $475,000 in the second year for grants to MPR. And when I chaired that committee, we had accountability language that said that they had to let the legislature and the public know, not names, but how many people on the payroll got paid more than $100,000 a year. It's very simple language. It was complied with for the first year, but in the second year, the Commissioner of Administration was given a list. Over 20 people were, over 20 positions were on the list, not names, but positions. And I just think it's a good reform measure that just lets people know if we're going to give money to an entity, that it'd be nice for us to know how many people on the payroll, if they're getting a government subsidy, are getting more than 100 grand. We found out there were over 20, and they complied with it, and that information is available from anybody who would like it, and I can get it to them. I'm wondering, Representative Yaros, if your committee decided to not want that language. If I know that you have interest in corporate welfare reform as well, and wondering if you would be amenable. I don't have the language in front of me, but if we came to the floor, that you might be amenable. It doesn't say they don't get the money. It just says that for them to get the money, that they have to let us know how many positions pay more than $100,000. And we had to actually, I think, bipartisan support. Representative Kahn, if you're still in the room, I don't think anyone objected from your side on the language when we did that, because it didn't cut off the money unless they didn't comply with the requirement. I'm wondering, Representative Yaros, just if I could talk with you privately, if you'd be interested in, if I could get the language. I'm not going to offer it now, but what are your thoughts on that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Seifert, I don't know. This never came up during our committee discussions or any other way. I suppose they have stars, like, you know, we pay athletes and actors and, you know, politicians are followed actors and athletes by the media. I don't know. I suppose they have to pay their people based on how famous they are. You heard that a famous Twins sports reporter died at age 83. He was known nationally. I suppose they had to pay him quite a bit. I don't know. We'll have to look into this.
Mr. Chair, I won't offer an amendment, but Representative Yaros, it wouldn't say they can't pay them. They could pay them $1 billion if they wanted to. It just say for them to get the money, they would just let us know how many positions are over $100,000 a year. And I'm fine doing that with other things, too. I think Representative Clark and Representative Clark and Representative Krinke had a corporate welfare reform bill of maybe about 5 years ago, if I remember right. And what it was is to try to get it in the public arena when the state gives out subsidy, what is, are we subsidizing a needy organization or an organization that does not have a considerable need? And when you have an organization that shelled out over $21 million for an expansion to its world headquarters, as well as has over 20 people on the payroll at six figures, I just think it's good for people to know that. I'm not saying that we shouldn't give them money per se. We might have a disagreement on whether they should get money or not, but at least that's one mild form of reform, and we could do it on different things. What the Clark Kroenke bill did is, I think it had a threshold, and then it basically kicked in on reporting requirements that legislators and the public would have a right to know when subsidies were given to organizations with really high salary structures that didn't cut anybody off. But and she might be able to have a better idea, but if you remember the details, but it was kind of a corporate, what I called a corporate welfare reform bill. And it was had a little more teeth than this one, if I remember right.
Mr. Chairman, should I respond to that?
We have several that have got their hands up as a result of that, Representative Rukavina.
Well, Madam Chair, or Mr. Chair and Representative Seifert, I was just wondering if you want to expand that to, like, Job Z and some the ethanol plants, which have gotten over $350 million over the last 10 years. Maybe we can find out to see how much some ethanol legislators are making. And then how about Thompson West under the proposal this year? You'd put all of those in there? That'd be great economic development, I'm sure, for the governor's office.
Is that a question for Representative Seifert?
Yeah, that was for Representative Seifert.
Mr. Chair, whatever it is to get more information to the public, Representative Clark just told me it didn't have anything to do with salaries, but more subsidies rather than anything. I think the more information, the better, frankly. And if we do it across the board, I'm not going to object to that. I think the public has a right to know if their money is going to need or not need. And I've got the largest ethanol plant in the state of Minnesota, and if you want me to help work out language on that, I'm not going to object to more information. It's not cutting anybody off, but I think generally we've had a pretty bipartisan agreement in the legislature that more information for the public is better if the public is putting money into an organization. If it's none of my business if a private organization pay somebody a gazillion dollars if they're doing it on their own dime, but I think some of the profit levels, Representative Rukavina might agree that the state pays a lot of organizations different things. And if we want to come up with a report, Commissioner of Administration administered the program that we put in place last year and worked with the Commissioner of Finance. It was a very easy one-page report. In fact, I'll try to dig it up and share it with the members so they have an idea of what we're talking about.
Representative Clark? Representative Clark, you indicated you wanted to comment.
Oh, yes, Mr. Chairman. Well, I'm just going to provide some additional information to Representative Seifert because it wasn't anything to do with salaries. It had to do with when we give any organization public subsidy, then we have a right to know what the public purpose is, first of all. We have a right to know what salaries are paid to the workers, what kind of jobs are created and what are the value of those jobs. I suppose you could take that up to the high CEO level, but what we were mostly talking about there, and I think what we got all the reports on, were what were the jobs that the workers in that particular company were being paid. So was it a good investment, in other words, and what was the public purpose? And there were public hearings involved with that, and we could go over that again, but it really didn't have to do with the salary of the top CEOs or anything like that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I won't offer an amendment if I could ask Representative Yaros just one quick question.
Representative Yaros.
Representative Yaros, when you described your bill, you didn't mention the History Center and the increase in rent, $250,000 a year. Could you tell us why it went so high?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative House, I don't know. That's the governor's recommendation. We just took it. I suppose we could try.
Okay, any further discussion on on the bill? And several of you came in after we started, and I had announced at the beginning that the three omnibus bills that are here this morning were to be presented, discussed, any amendments taken, Then they would be laid over until after the spring break, and pending the final outcome of discussions with the Senate alignment on various accounts, there may be amendments dealing with these bills and other bills then for that alignment purpose, which is one of the responsibilities of this committee. So when we're done with the discussion, we'll be simply laying the bill over then until after the spring break. Representative Yaros, yep. Did you have any concluding comments?
Well, just a couple, of, Mr. Chairman and members. I remember when I was chairing Economic Development, Trade, and Tourism, we had a bill that dealt with living wage for companies to pay living wage if they are getting state subsidy. Governor Carlson's commissioner of DTED, Novak, did that pretty much on his own, and I have to check and see if that is still in force. But you know, if someone wants to introduce a bill to require disclosure of salaries of the people that are getting state subsidy, you know, generally that's fine.
If there are no further questions, or Representative Cornish, excuse me.
Mr. Chair, members, Representative Jaros, just for your information, and I have had several conversations, and a couple of the projects that I ran short on this year, one was USC Wells, and Representative Houlton will hopefully help me on that next year. But the other one was the Agricultural Interpretive Center in Waseca. And we have three interpretive centers, one Iron World in Chisholm and a Forest History Center in Grand Rapids that get funded rather well. But the Agricultural Interpretive Center in Waseca, I've come with it 4 years now and still yet to really see any increase in funding. And they're struggling to survive with many volunteers. And Representative Jaros, I'm just, you know, a little bit upset about that. I didn't offer any amendments, and we'll come back to vigorously lobby you next year for funding. I have a hard time with funding Garrison Peeler to make squeaky door noises at the same time our doors are squeaking down there, and we need a lot of help. And so I'll come back after you next year. Thank you much for talking to me about it.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, Representative Cornish, I hope we have more operational money. We had just one-time money, only two. I had... they gave me, whoever decided, gave me only two tails for the next, and the one was for Humanities Commission, which was reestablished, and the capital tours fee elimination. Those are the only two that we got.
Mr. Chairman, and very shortly, with all due respect to the author and in the spirit of cooperation, I would suggest that the author and his staff, or the majority staff, look at what this bill will be $10 million less. This bill is chock full with earmarks. Obviously, there's lots of interest groups and lobbyists here of interest groups who love those earmarks. I'm not sure that that's true about the citizens of Minnesota. This bill will pass at the end of the session, but it will pass significantly less than it is right now. So I would suggest, out of humble advice, that the author and the staff and the majority look at the cooperation at the end, what's going to be necessary to finish the session, to finish at the end of May, and this bill will have less money in it the second time around. The second phase will have less money in it. Prepare for it.
The Representative Sertich.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cornish, you mentioned Iron World and the significant amount of money it gets. I wonder if Representative Rucavina would yield to a question. He actually has served a lot longer in northern Minnesota than I have, and actually has worked at Iron World doing some recordings. So, Representative Rucavina, would you like to comment a bit on the significant amount of money that Iron World has received over the years from the state of Minnesota?
Representative Rucavina.
Mr. Chair, Representative Sertich, zero is the dollar amount. They get their funding from the mining companies, and Representative Cornish, I'd be more than happy to help you structure a way to get a few pennies out of a bushel of corn or sugar beets or whatever to fund your project. That's the way we do it.
You, Representative Seifert?
Mr. Chair, just a procedural question in regard to the bills that are traveling through, and I don't know if Representative Sertich would know the answer, you know, how they're going to be combined and conferred. You had said, is this one going to be laid over and combined with another bill and voted on with something else? and the Senate's going to conferee it with a like bill, or could you just walk us through that so we have an idea and the public kind of knows?
Yeah, the negotiations, I think, are fairly close to being concluded with the House and the Senate on the alignment of the bills, and which ultimately will align the conference committees as well. And so hopefully that will be wrapped up this week, and in fact, I know it will be. And then these three bills, to save a little time, we brought forward with the purpose of having the overview of the amendments, and then there will be motions on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday after spring break when the other omnibus bills are before us dealing with the alignments of the accounts.
Mr. Chair, that answers your question. Mr. Chair, would those bills be combined in this committee or in the Ways and Means Committee?
The jurisdiction of this committee for purposes is part of our charge, as I mentioned earlier, is the alignment of the accounts.
So, Mr. Chair, we will hold the bills to combine them all after Easter break.
That's right.
Okay.
And that's the purpose this morning. After the break, when we're done with these bills, the intent is that that would conclude the amendments and so on, and we would simply have these motions to align them with other bills and take it from there. Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thurgood, maybe my comments were misconstrued here. I in no way meant anything against the History Center or Forest History Center or Ironwater. I've been to both of them, and they're great places. And I didn't mean to mean the state had a lot to do with their funding. I just said they were funded rather well. I just meant to point out we have one interpretive center. But, no, I have no problem with the way they are funded. It's just that they're doing rather well, and the wires are lagging. So.
Okay, with that, Representative Westrum.
Mr. Chair, just while we're talking about process in the next week, just in forecasting out, then you would estimate that the week after the Easter recess, we'll be busy reviewing omnibus bills, and will they be on the floor then shortly after, maybe the following week?
I think the tentative plan, and Representative Sturdage can correct me if I'm wrong, I think the goal is to have or to start having the omnibus bills on the floor about the 17th. Isn't that the plan, Representative Sturdage?
Mr. Chair, yes, that is the plan.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Representative Yarles moves that House File 1660, First Committee Engrossment, be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Any discussion on that motion? Hearing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Aye. Motion carried. We'll now go to Representative Yarles.
Thank you.
Representative Slawik. The Early Childhood House File 1056.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move 1056, the second committee engrossment, to be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
We will take the division report first, so that would be the first motion. And Representative Slawik moves adoption of the, or excuse me, Representative Murphy, because it comes out of Representative Murphy's committee, I guess. It's, Representative Murphy moves adoption of the Education, Finance, and Economic Competitive Division Report for House File 1056. Any discussion on the Murphy motion? Hearing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. And now the Representative Slawik's motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I move House File 1056, Second Committee Engrossment, to be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Okay, that motion is before us, and we now have, I see here an amendment. So let's take the amendment to get it in the order that you would like. Representative Slawik moves the amendment A61.
Yes.
Representative Slawik.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, I have two amendments. This is just an author's amendment. Puts the bill so that it balances and in the shape we need it. Would appreciate your support.
Any discussion on the amendment? Huh? Okay. Hearing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Then Representative Slawik, you have a second amendment.
Yes, Mr. Chair, A60.
And these are amendments to get the bill in the form that the author would like. So Representative Slawik moves the amendment. Any discussion on the amendment? Hearing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion carried. There is another amendment here, an A59. That's not an author's amendment, I take it. So let's give the author an opportunity to describe the bill, and then we will take the additional amendment. Representative Slawik.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. First of all, I want to note that the Early Childhood Learning Finance Committee bill passed with broad bipartisan support out of our committee on a vote of 12 to 1. It came out of our committee, and so I'm sure that today before your committee, it will also enjoy strong bipartisan support. This bill spends about the same as the governor spent, about $40 million. It also had a TANF increase of $24 million, 17 of which was one time. Our bill accomplished four goals. It makes smart investments to narrow the achievement gap and increases quality in child care and preschool settings. It increases citizen engagement in early childhood and family education issues, and it encourages innovation and reform to early childhood education in Minnesota. So briefly, I'll just talk a little bit about each one. First of all, this bill makes smart investments to narrow the achievement gap, delivering the biggest bang for the buck. The bill restores funding to Head Start, school readiness, and ECFE, all that were cut under the Republican majority. I think our families and our young children will be thrilled to have those programs back at the 2003 levels. Currently, more than half of children entering kindergarten lack the basic skills necessary to succeed in school. Children with quality early learning experiences are 40% less likely to need special education or to be held back a grade. This bill also provides funding for two scholarship programs. We looked at a variety of scholarship programs in our committee. We decided to fund two. Both target low-income, at-risk families. One program will be in two rural communities to complement the scholarship program that MELF, that's the Minnesota Early Learning Foundation, is piloting in St. Paul, Minneapolis. So our committee chose to do that. We also are funding the governor's scholarships, which will be administered by the Department of Education. Both are funded at the $2.5 million level. This bill also funds basic sliding fee child care for $11 million to decrease the waiting lists. This will directly help families to get their children into quality care where they can prepare for school. Secondly, it increases quality in child care and preschool settings, giving parents more quality choices. It increases the professional development. We know whether the kids are with grandma or they're in a high-quality child care setting, that it's the quality of the adults and what the adults are doing with the kids that really matters. So this invests in that professional development. It also provides funding for the governor's school readiness service agreements. And one provision I think the members will like a lot is it caps child care licensing fees to $50. Remember when all those fees were going up and they weren't called taxes but called fees? Child care fees were one of those things that could go up to $150 per year. So what this bill does is it caps it at $50 so we can keep our child care providers in business, and it also picks up the background checks for those providers. Third, this bill increases citizen engagement in early childhood and family education. We have adult basic education under our area, and this bill funds that to strengthen and stabilize families. It also expands access to GED preparation and testing, and it provides funding for after-school community grants that will keep our youth engaged in learning activities after school. Now, some of you, I remember Representative Mariani and some of you that were sat on the first Early Childhood Committee way back in 97-98, we had an after-school grant program that was defunded and then unallotted by the governor. So this puts back $5 million into opportunities for kids. Lastly, this encourages innovation and reform into early childhood education, provides funding for public participation in the School Readiness Advisory Board. This is a 13-member board that will work with the governor and the legislature to develop a coordinated, efficient, and cost-effective system for delivering early childhood programs that focus on early care and education, health care, and family support. It also funds an innovative program around community hubs. When rural, urban, and suburban sites, these hubs will fund the transition for kids going from preschool programs into kindergarten programs. So, Mr. Chair and members, that is the Early Childhood Learning Finance.
Okay. Any discussion on the bill at this point, and then we'll take that amendment shortly. Representative Pepin.
Mr. Chair and Representative Slawik, what exactly, I'm sorry because I'm not on this committee, but the child care assistance money, what does that
pay for, and what is the percent increase on that proposal?
Well, I'm going to turn to Adrian's for the percent increase, but I will tell you what it goes for. What the state's responsibility and the government's responsibility in child care is helping families transition first when they're on welfare to finding jobs, and then when they're getting into jobs, transitioning into work, hopefully into self-sufficiency. So it's a very specific role that the government funds in child care. You know, when those 2003 cuts happened, almost 1,000 child cares have closed since 2003, and over $100 million was cut out of this program since 2003. So we had a lot of families that are struggling to make it, and really this is about getting folks off of welfare and keeping their families stable. I'll turn to Ms. Adrians for the percentage increase. She's our fiscal analyst.
Mr. Chair,
welcome
members,
to the committee.
For overall, for all of the child care development, I assume you mean it's about a just under 17% increase from the 2008-09 base to the recommendation for the committee.
Representative Pepin.
So, again, on Representative Slawick, so the child care assistance, that isn't for educational programs, that would just be for daycare, is that correct?
Well, you know, Representative Pepin, I mean, you have kids like I do, daycare and educational programs are the same. Kids are learning whether they're in child care or preschool or with mom or with grandma. So as I see it, they're somewhat synonymous, they're the same.
It's all a matter of opinion, I guess. Thank you.
Okay, we have Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Pepin, I just noticed in the paper today that former governor of Wisconsin, Tommy Thompson, is entering the race, and he was, of course, nationally recognized as well for his work as a conservative in the areas of human services. And he said, I read in the paper today, that he was going to be entering the race so there would be a true conservative in the race. And a true conservative was what he was when he was working on things like child care assistance and transition off of welfare. And we learned from him when Minnesota was doing it that you really need to fund child care when people are transitioning off of welfare, if you're going to get them off of welfare at all. So this isn't daycare for you or for me. This is for people getting off of welfare who are working and getting trained and having jobs that they can be off of welfare and off of the public dole. And I know that as a true conservative like Tommy Thompson, who recognized this need and funded it really well, it costs more in the short term to get people off of welfare because of child care. I know that you are a true conservative, and in this area, I think everyone in this room is. Our goal is to get parents off of welfare and into jobs so they can be paying taxes and paying their own child care, and that's what this bill does. It's not just child care for you and me. It's for people getting off of welfare, which we want.
Here we have Representative Seifert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, a couple questions. I guess the first one would be, we looked at the spreadsheet. The governor's budget put in quite a bit more money for early childhood. According to this, there's a $54 million less that the House Democrats have than what the governor recommended. I'm wondering, where did all the money go if your target was roughly the same as the governor's recs?
Mr. Chair, Representative Seifert, really what the governor put all the early childhood money in primarily was his scholarship program. And what our committee looked at is, what are the needs of kids? What is the role of the committee? What's the responsibility of our committee in terms of state government? The scholarships are an untested model. They are being piloted right now in St. Paul by the Minnesota Early Learning Foundation. What our committee had discussions about is, we need to see what happens with those pilots, and then maybe it's time to make a significant investment into the scholarships. But really, the governor was putting all of his money into scholarships without them being tested, without it knowing where they would go. So the committee decided to put some of the money into obviously restoring the cuts, the deep cuts that were made under Republican majority leadership, to ECFB, Head Start, and school readiness. We also decided to put some of that into child care because the governor had not put very much money into child care. And again, child care is early learning.
Mr. Chair, my second question is
Representative Seifert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, my second question is in relationship to eligibility standards. What would a person, my wife and I have two kids that are in daycare, so I'm just kind of running through this in my mind. What would a person, what would your family income be per year to get child care assistance under this new model? Has it changed, or is it the same as it always was? And what would a family like mine qualify? Two kids under the age of five in child care.
Mr. Chair, Representative Seifert, this bill, as you know, there was a bit debate about if this bill was too small or too big when some of the headlines came out. One said DFL or House proposal supports early childhood, and one the other paper said early childhood left off the bus. You know, frankly, one thing we couldn't do is change eligibility. That was one thing that was really, really expensive and probably the most egregious cut that took place since 2003 because people have to be at such a low level. I believe it is 75%, 175% of poverty level.
Mr. Chair, is there a number, Representative Slawick, in terms of what would that be about?
I believe that's about 40,000. Some of the Health and Human Services folks. It's 175% for a family of four.
Yep.
Would be about $37,000.
So a legislator would qualify for this program under the assumption that, you know, depending on what your per diem is, I suppose. Well, Mr. Chair, I guess the final question I have is if the most egregious, outrageous, ridiculous cuts under the Republicans were eligibility, why aren't you doing something about it? You're in charge now. You've got an overwhelming majority in the House and the Senate. You've got an overwhelming majority on all these committees. You know, if that's where the priority is, if that was the most outrageous cuts, why isn't there a change? If there's not one penny of difference in that area, I'm trying to figure out, you know, why would the advocates say, hey, you're doing a great job if those are the most outrageous cuts? It doesn't make a lot of sense to say this was the most outrage and then on the flip side not doing anything about it.
Representative Slawick.
Mr. Chair, Representative Seifert, as we were putting our bill together, we looked at all the different options of what we could do in early childhood. The area that's controlled by the Department of Education and Child Care, which is over in Department of Human Services, believe me, I wanted to do something about it. There just wasn't enough money. We have one of the smaller targets, as you might know. It costs so much to buy back eligibility. And then it's hard to know, as you know, in forecasted programs, if say all of you were eligible, but only half of you applied, it's hard to know how many people are actually going to apply and use that money. So you actually have to put it at the top number from a fiscal perception to restore that. So it was too expensive. We thought that doing the market rate, restoring the cuts to ECFE so more parents and kids could have programs, school readiness so more kids could get ready for school, that those were the investments that we wanted to make. Of course, we're hoping to come back in 2 years and be able to make a dent in that eligibility at that time.
Mr. Chair, I guess who sets the targets that we can find out who the culprit is and Representative Slawick not having enough money to deal with the problems that she has in her committee? It sure wasn't me. I never had a vote on the floor. I'm trying to find out who it was that gave her such low targets that we're not doing one penny of difference in eligibility. Is there someone who I can find out so I can go see them and ask them about this?
The targets, I think, as you know, Representative Seifert, are set in the Ways and Means Committee. We now have an amendment before us, A-59. I don't have a name on this one.
I'll offer the amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Representative Swiga moves H-1056-A-59. Any discussion on the amendment, Representative Swiga?
Mr. Chairman, members, as the author of the bill tried to outreach to all members on the committee here to try to include them in the support of the bill, she used somewhat harsh rhetoric. Somewhat interesting in the harsh rhetoric she used to find out that the harsh, drastic cuts of eligibility were not reversed, Representative Seifert. That's very, very interesting. Members, my short memory from 4 years ago tells me that when we were facing that significant deficit in the area of child care, as we did make some reductions without question, which are not changed here in this bill, by the way, but as we made some reductions, I think my memory tells me that we went from child care assistance in the region, in this entire region, in this country, from number one in the region to number one in the region. Absolutely true. After the small reductions that were made, we went from number one to number one. We were still the leading state, at least in this entire region, in regards to child care assistance, and that's what my memory tells me. As I look at this bill, I see the bills put together in such a way that I would say it's fairly heavy on child care assistance grants and fairly light on the initiatives of early childhood like that the governor would like to recommend. So before you, members, is the choice that we have, taking the one-time pan of dollars, and rather than going to take the one-time pan of dollars to the MFEP and the basic side care, child care assistance grant money programs, putting into the childhood scholarship program that the governor recommended. The governor asked for $29 million in this this program for the scholarship for early childhood. The committee saw fit to only give them 10% of that, even a little less than 10%, about $2.5 million. I think this amendment before you represents a little bit more of a balanced approach between child care and the early education program needs. Would appreciate your support.
Okay, the amendment is before us, Representative Hogg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Swiggum, I'd like to speak against the amendment and encourage a no vote. This bill decreases the waiting list, decreases the copayments, works with the absent day policy, restores half day rates. This bill does a lot for our families. And, you know, we felt we were generous in including, there was a long time, Representative Swiggum, where the governor's scholarship program was completely left out of the bill. And I worked with the governor's office, and we now have it on the table along with a rural pilot program. Again, this program, scholarships are being piloted by the Minnesota Early Learning Foundation. We want to see what happens with this money. So when it's time to make that significant investment, the market is ready. It's not clear right now what a quality program is that these scholarships are going to go to. It's not clear how it would be administered to families. We think this is the right amount that we've put in this bill, and the committee's worked hard on this bill to put it together. And so I'd encourage a no vote.
Okay, Representative Westrum. Was that on the
Mr. Chair, I guess my comments were more to the bill, so I'll let the amendment be voted on. Representative Swiggum, did you want a roll call on it? I didn't hear the answer to that. So.
Yeah, that'd be good, Representative Westrum. If you'd call for it.
Mr. Chair, I'd request
a roll call has been requested. Representative Graham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Swiggum, all the cuts that that the governor and your caucus made can't be made up for in one fell swoop with the amount of money that we have available. But this bill is certainly a good start on filling in the holes that were created under your leadership. But your amendment now, again, tries to throw out the balance, funding something new that we haven't had before when we really owe bills. And the bill that you're trying to not pay is the bill that gets people off of welfare. So your amendment is to increase people staying on welfare and not making a successful transition to work. And I would urge all members to vote against it who are true conservatives.
Mr. Chairman, just a quick response.
Several hands up, but we're going to go in the order, but under the maker of the amendment, then Representative Seifert, or I mean Swiggum.
Mr. Chairman, with knowing that sometimes one should think before he responds just very quickly, I will wait to listen to a couple other members before I respond to Representative Greiling and say something I ought not say.
Representative Sertich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Representative Swiggum's amendment, he spoke of choices, but with choices come consequences. In this, if we go forward with going fully with the governor's scholarships, actually they won't pay for a full day of quality child care per child. So I think it's most appropriate, Representative Slawick, Chair Slawick, has brought forward as a pilot project to see the effectiveness of this. and in voting for the Sirgham Amendment, we'd be actually taking away resources for full-day child care service, which I think is the wrong direction to go. I would encourage a no vote.
Representative Seifert.
Mr. Chairman, I guess I'm wondering, after all this is reconciled, my understanding is I haven't read the House DFL Human Services proposal, but Senator Berglund's bill basically undoes the work requirements for welfare, raises eligibility, makes it open for more families, more people to ride on the wagon, if you will. If these things are all reconciled, at the end of the day, are we going to have this old system of where people will have child care and not have to work? If we take the House and the logical conclusion to the Senate DFL House or the Senate DFL welfare bill and this bill, we're going to have the opposite. What Representative Greiling's going to talk about, we're going to have nobody working. We're going to have people with their kids in state paid child care. And I don't think that's the direction that the people of Minnesota want to go. I never heard it about any of this during the campaign that we were going to do welfare reform. But I'm trying to look at a logical conclusion to an illogical process, that if these things are conferred, maybe we can get assurances from Representative Thiessen and Huntley, since they're the chairs and very likely going to be on the conference committee, that if we're going to go down this route that you're arguing on work requirements, that we're not going to take the Senate position in terms of undoing any work requirements, because you can't have it both ways and say, well, we need to have state-paid child care because we need people to move off of welfare and to work, and then on the other hand, get rid of the work requirements in the welfare bill. Could I have him address that so I can make an informed decision when I vote, Mr. Chair?
If he chooses, we don't have the Huntley bill before us at this point, but if you want to give it just a quick response, Representative Huntley, otherwise we'll wait until after spring break.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Seifert, as one of the Dirty 13 that passed welfare reform in this state and was picketed in my office for doing so, the purpose of that was not just to get people off of welfare, it was to get them out of poverty. And this child care is essential to get these people not only into the workforce, but also out of poverty.
Okay, the amendment is before us. So any further discussion on A-59? Representative Sviggum.
Mr. Chairman, just very briefly, just for members to know, that the choice before us right here is a choice of what I would consider a little more balanced choice between child care and early childhood programs. It does move some money to early childhood programs as opposed to child care. Members, we don't need to, I imagine, go back or go ahead as to what was done and why, but I do find it fairly interesting that the Governor Plenty in his first year was able to balance a budget of $4.5 billion of deficit, keep Minnesota number one in the region in child care assistance. A lot of criticisms, a lot of complaints, and when a new majority changes, doesn't reverse the eligibilities to which they criticized very significantly. I just find it a little ironic.
The motion is before us. A roll call was requested. Clerk will take the roll.
Carlson?
No.
Anderson?
Yes.
Clark? Cornish?
Aye.
Earhart? Finstead?
Yes.
Garofalo? Greiling?
No.
Hackbarth?
Yes.
Hausman?
No.
Hilty?
No.
Howes? Huntley?
No.
Yaros?
No.
Junkie? Kahn?
No.
Holes?
Aye.
Lancheski?
No.
Leader? Mahoney?
No.
Mariani?
No.
Murphy?
No.
Otremba?
No.
Paymar?
No.
Polowski?
No.
Pepin?
Yes.
Poppy?
No.
Rukavina?
No.
Saylor?
No.
Seifert?
Yes.
Sertich?
No.
Severson?
Yes.
Simon?
No.
Slavik?
No.
Solberg?
No.
Swiggum?
Yes.
Thiessen?
No.
Wagenius?
No.
Walker?
No.
Westrom?
Yes.
Junkie votes no.
Chair? Clark votes no.
Okay, there being 26 no's and 10 yeses, the amendment is defeated. We now have the bill before us. Representative Weston indicated you had a comment about the bill.
Chair, I got a couple questions. Representative Slawick, you talked about you raising it from the 03 levels. What has the level of funding in your bill been exactly the same since 2003? Could you or the fiscal analyst remind the committee of the budget in 03 and then the budget in 05? What were those numbers?
Representative Slawick.
Mr. Chair, Representative Westrom, I'll ask the fiscal analyst was talking to one of the members. So you want to know from 2003 to 2005 at the
and today, Representative Slawick, you started off your comments by indicating that your raise was getting rid of the Republican majority cuts and restoring levels to 2003. What were those levels of 2003? But what was the cuts and then? Did that budget that came out of 2003, was that the exact same budget that you had 4 years later?
Let's go, Ms. Adrian, to respond.
Mr. Chair and members, my understanding, I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but my understanding is that the biggest cuts were made in 2003, and what this recommendation does is restores a number of those programs, but also gives a slight increase to account for things like different client, different caseloads and inflation, et cetera.
So,
Representative Weston.
Mr. Chair, Adria, I believe that's your name. What was that number? And in 2005, was nothing ever changed? So we went 4 years with the same number that came out of the 2003 budget? Is that what we're being told?
Ms. Adrian.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm afraid I don't have that number right in front of me, but I believe that it has stayed pretty consistent. I'm not sure. There are some people here from DHS, and they may be able to speak a little bit more to that point.
Mr. Chair.
Would you like to...
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm amazed that the chair of the committee wouldn't know her bill a little better than this, but the DHS could offer us some of that insight. As I recall, the 2005 budget that was passed in the legislature was bigger than the 2003 budget, and so I'm just curious what that number was and then how that number relates to today's increases.
Representative Slawick.
Mr. Chair, Representative Westrom, I don't have the exact numbers. We did do an increase in 2005, specifically, as you might remember, that Senator Hottinger had an early childhood committee in the Senate and was also retiring at that same time. And so I know there were increases. And Representative Westrom, we have not had an early childhood committee here in the House for a number of years. We used to have one, as you remember, Representative Sikora used to chair it. Back when you guys were in charge, but it's hard for us to draw out comparisons because this has not been a sitting committee. These two areas have been separated both into the Department of Human Services and the Department of Education. There were some increases, but I know for ECFB getting it back to the $120 level, we have not seen that since 2003. For school readiness and for Head Start, we have not seen those increases back since then. It was a priority. House File Number 5, authored by Representative Bly, restored these cuts. This was a priority for us. This had been not done for a long time. You and I both know if you took these numbers back to the 2003 level and did an inflationary projection, you know, a projection of where they would be, the numbers would be much higher at this point if you just simply funded inflation. So bringing these numbers back to the 2003 levels is the best we can do in this bill, and we certainly think it's a good thing and the right thing to be doing.
Well, Mr. Chair, I've got a few more comments, just so you know. Representative Slawik, maybe we should go through a little history lesson here, and you make a pretty good argument that you're living within the means of the targets you've got today. You know, in 2003, there was other means that were lived within, whether it was Republicans or Democrats, and you seem to want to be awfully partisan in your presentation. So it's funny how you refer to Representative Hottinger and the DFL in the Senate when you try to give maybe a little credit to some increase in 05, which I think the House Republicans also supported. In fact, at one stage had a higher number than the Senate DFL. But Representative Slawik, if you go back to 2003, and I might be corrected by Representative Seifert, but I believe the DFL was also in charge in the Senate that also passed the budget, lived with the constraints of the $4.5 billion deficit. And so while you justify your bill in not going back to new numbers today because you don't have any more money, remember that people in 2003, legislators, Democrats and Republicans, also had budget constraints that they had to live with and made the best decisions they can. So your argument sounds like logic was made in 2003 to make the best decisions possible, which is what you're justifying your lack of increase today is because that's the constraints you also live in. So if you want to keep down this partisan road, we'll just have to keep having some history lessons. But that's how I recall it, and I do believe the Democrats were also in charge in the Senate. And if this was such an outrageous priority, it's funny that they wouldn't have solved the problem any better. And it's also ironic that you haven't solved it by raising eligibilities if that was the most egregious cut. But getting back to your bill, Representative Slawik, you introduced the first part as narrowing the education gaps for early childhood. And this fall, a lot of material I received from different groups said that there's a 50% deficiency in school readiness in kids starting kindergarten. What was that gap about 20 years ago? Do you have any idea? What have we raised it to? We've raised it to 50% apparently, which isn't a good figure if that figure in fact is correct. What was that number 20 years ago, and what are we going to try to get that number to?
Mr. Chair, Representative Westrum, you probably know that the Department of Education has been officially assessing kids when they enter kindergarten for about 3 years. So there's three annual reports, and they give a variety of tests on about five different areas on how kids are doing. So we only have data that goes back as far as 3 years on how kids are doing and if they're ready for school. One of the great things this bill does, another great thing it does, is it actually allows for assessing 30% of the kids so we get a more accurate picture. Right now it's about 10% of kids that are being assessed. So part of it is I think we'll probably agree on that we need to really focus in on how kids are being assessed, what they're being asked, and kind of where we're going on that. And our committee thought, well, maybe we should assess more kids, see how that's going, see if that 50% level raises up.
Well, so, Madam, Mr. Chair, Representative Slawik, we don't know what that number was 20 years ago.
Mr. Chair, I can't say, Representative Westrum, I can't say that I know. I wasn't in the legislature, and neither were you. Maybe do you know, Representative Westrum?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Slawik, that's a assume what committee work would be about is asking experts, because we aren't all experts on everything, and that's part of the committee process. But it'd be nice to have some benchmarks, Representative Slawik. But what you replied that we're going to do now more money into assessments, it seems to me that if we're educating people, those that people educating usually can assess which kids need more work while they're educating them. We don't need to spend money just assessing them. But I hope that money is being used in tandem rather than just on assessments, because if it's about getting them ready, we need to put money into the actual educating, teaching them reading and writing, alphabets, other basic structures as we all learned going into kindergarten. But, Mr. Chair, what exactly will that first part of your bill that you talked about due to help raise the achievement and readiness for our children? I mean, what are some tangible things that are going to happen under this bill that haven't been happening in the past, so in fact we'll have that gap closing that you referred to?
Mr. Chair, Representative Westrom, I think that's a great question, because this bill really makes smart investments to narrow the achievement gap. It really delivers the biggest bang for the buck. One, it restores that funding to Head Start. Now, we know Head Start kids are at the poverty level, and Head Start is a program that works with their academics. It also works with their health care and dental checkups and all of that. So it's helping kids get up to speed. What we're really trying to do here is prevent the achievement gap before it ever starts. So funding to Head Start will get more kids ready for school that way. School readiness. School readiness is a program for kids that are identified as not ready for kindergarten, needing some help with their skills. So again, this get allows the money allows more kids to participate in the program, more kids to go to a preschool program to learn about their colors, their numbers, the social skills, all the things that they need to get ready. It's also got, this bill, as you know, has the two scholarship programs, so about $4,000 a piece is going to go out into those two rural pilots, help families find that quality child care, that quality preschool program, so they get some extra opportunities to go and get their kids ready. And we fund, as you know, the governor's scholarship program directly is one of those things, this bill, that affects and narrows the achievement gap. Also, the basic sliding fee child care for $11 million will decrease the waiting lists, so kids that are out there waiting for quality child care can now access it. So there's really a number of strategies. You know, I think all of us here at the legislature are under a lot of pressure, particularly as kids, and you know this, Representative Westrom, as they get into the third grade, they need to already start performing on tests. So if we can just help kids with those basic skills right off the bat, and that's what this bill does. It also, you know, one of the concerns, Representative Eastland was the lead for the Republicans, was keeping it a private system. This bill keeps it a private system. This is not about a public takeover. It's about helping families. It's about helping families make good choices. It's about helping kids get ready.
Mr. Chair, last area. Representative Slawick, you talked about the scholarships, $4,000 each. Tell me, what does that do? $4,000, walk us through those two pilot projects in rural Minnesota. What is it going to do? It's going to let people, give them a little bit of money so they have time to go find quality child care or education systems? Is that what you said? Or... it just doesn't seem like $4,000 is going to do much, but, I mean, how are we spending it? Maybe would $40,000 do much, or it seems like finding daycare or education programs is something that most parents engage in, and not everybody has the same fit for what they think is quality. But how is that $4,000 going to be divvied up to, in fact, reach kids? It doesn't seem like $4,000 would go very far.
Mr. Chair, Representative Westrom, good observation. Same observation the committee members made on both sides of the aisle. You know, we had a child care provider come in from the YWCA early in session, and she said that they spend $14,000 to educate a child. That's the real cost when you're including the cost. And, you know, the cost driver in quality child care is mostly with hiring staff and doing that. The governor, this is the same. This is the governor's proposal, the rural pilot proposal. Both are about for $4,000 each. It allows that parent to have some parent choice to go out and find a quality child care program. They're supposed to be certified or a deemed quality, and sign their child up to get that quality preschool experience. In reality, Representative Westrom, with the rural pilots and the governor's scholarship program, they'll fund about a half day of care potentially or less for a child. Or they could also fund some wraparound, what we call wraparound child care. If a Head Start program is half a day, it could provide the other half a day. Both the rural pilot program and the governor's scholarship program are income eligible. So again, these are hitting the kids that need it the most and have the most risk factors.
Well, Mr. Chair, that really didn't answer my question. So is it $4,000 goes to one kid for half a day for a year? That sounds about what it would cost. Is that how it goes? So one family gets selected in each of these two rural communities? Is that how it's divided up? That's my question. How is this money getting divided up? I didn't quite understand your response.
Mr. Chair, Representative Westrom, it's $4,000 per family. Again, the certificate goes to the family to make that choice. It provides for a number of $2.5 million divided by 4,000 would be the number of scholarships that would be provided. So in the rural areas, fiscal analyst, about 625 of these scholarships would be provided. And Representative Westrom, you know, we directed this to the rural areas because it is being piloted in the city areas. So 625 additional families could find, have a quality child care experience. I think that's significant, and we want to see how this works. That's why it's a pilot.
All right. Thanks.
Got two more people, and then I think we'll take the vote on the bill. We've got Representative Seifert, then Representative Pepin, and then I'll ask the author of the bill to make any concluding comments, and we'll take a vote. Representative Seifert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Real quickly, Mr. Chair, maybe Mr. Marks could help us out. I'm trying to get the answer to Representative Westrom's question that we had all these egregious cuts in 2003. We made up some or most of those cuts in 2005. How much was made up in 2005, Mr. Marks, or your fiscal analyst? If you could just give us a ballpark, 1%, half of it.
Mr. Marks.
Mr. Chair, Representative Seifert, we don't have the information here going back to 2003 to make those comparisons. We'll pull that together, but we don't have it right now.
Okay, Mr. Chair, the point is that this bill is not making up for all the cuts in 2003. We did in 2005, when the economy got better and revenue started coming back in, make up a portion of the reduction. So, you know, I would maybe put away the cape and that we're a heroine here and so forth. I mean, I appreciate the fact we're making up the reductions here, but to say we're doing it one swoop and we didn't have an intervening budget cycle is just not accurate. Some of the reductions were made up in 05. Secondly, I have on page 8 the parent fee schedule, and it actually goes up to 249% rather than 175%, Mr. Chair. I asked Representative Thiessen, since he chairs this other committee, and he thought that would maybe get you up around $50,000 per family. Would that be right, Representative Thiessen?
All I said was that 250% of poverty is about $50,000 for a family of four. I don't know how the fee schedule works because that doesn't come through our committee.
Okay, so Mr. Chair, if you were a legislator making $31,000 and you had a wife who worked part-time, you could potentially be eligible for the child parent fee schedule, apparently. I guess I just have one or two other questions, and then I'm done, Mr. Chair. On page 52, line 7, I'm wondering what precariously housed means. I don't have my dictionary from the weekend. I think precariously housed is in that dictionary, but could Representative Slawick tell me what precariously housed means?
Mr. Chair, Representative Seifert, this was a Representative Frank Hornstein initiative. He brought to us a city council member that was interested in having GED fees for the homeless to try a program for them to have their fees partially paid for. The reason for this is you have homeless individuals that are trying to get their high school degrees and trying to move forward. We know, members, that the single most determining factor of how a child does is the level of the mother's education. So here's some moms and dads trying to get a leg up, get a GED, and it is providing homeless folks with part of their entrance fee. Precariously housed, I think that maybe Representative Clark knows that definition.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Clark on that point.
Yep. The phrase precariously housed usually means people don't have a place to stay from one night to the next, and I can give you an example of a person who's staying with a relative one night, but they can't stay there the next night, and they don't know where they're going. They may be out on the street. They may be staying with a friend. They just do not have a permanent home, and they're just trying to find a place to stay probably each and every night.
Yeah,
sometimes it's a week or two, but it's pretty precarious.
Representative Seifert.
Mr. Chair, lastly, on the last page, as members know, when we do repealers and bills, I thought our joint rules, and Representative Kahn can correct me if I'm wrong, stated that whenever we have a repealer in a bill, we are supposed to have an addendum on the back of the bill that states what we're repealing so we can read it. Representative Earhart used to bring this up in Ways and Means, I think, every committee. I don't have any language on what we're repealing. And for omnibus bills, this is pretty important because you can repeal all sorts of things and the legislators of both sides don't even know what we're repealing. Can I just ask procedurally what, you know, are we going to start having that again? Representative Kahn, no. Do we have to ask House Research to do it? Or I'm not. This isn't Representative Slawick's deal. I mean, she's just the author.
Who are you posing the question to? Try to get a response.
I don't know. Representative Kahn, perhaps, because she worked with me on this to get make sure that everybody knows what they're voting on.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I asked the revisor's office about this when we were there because we discovered that it kind of appeared on some bills and didn't appear on the others, and it depends which computer system the bills come. It was an answer that didn't make a lot of sense, but it was some kind of automatic thing. If it goes through a certain part of the computer system, it pops up, and it doesn't on another one. And it's I think it's a reasonable thing to ask. And, you know, I guess if it doesn't automatically come up when the bill is engrossed, I would ask staff to, in the future, write those out for the committee. But I guess we can just ask what the repealer is.
It's in your summary, but what you're requesting is it actually be attached to the report as it's sometimes been. I think for today, and of course keep in mind that we're going to be laying this bill over for future inclusion, but if you take a look at the House Research Bill summary, the repealer has identified repeals outdated ABE language is what it says there, but I think Representative Kahn and Representative Seifert have made a good point. So we'll make that request here and now. But it is before us for today. We have Representative Hausman. Okay. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Slawick, on page 15, it talks about absences due to document and medical conditions of a parent or a sibling would not be counting toward the 25-day absent day limit in a fiscal year. I'm just wondering why we're putting that language in to exempt these people with medical.
Representative Slawick.
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, we have worked closely with the child care community on these provisions in terms of absent day. What happens is for little kids, if the parents have a condition, you see here a parent or a sibling in the same residence, then often the parents can't get the children to the child care. And so the child might be absent from child care simply because the parent is ill or a sibling. So in this case, and what happens is that, you know, it goes up to 25 days, and then at that point there starts penalties. So it's so that, and 25 days is really only two a month. When you think about it, if these are your lowest income, most at-risk families, and often that can be an issue. So this allows that type of an absence.
Okay. Representative Westbrook.
Mr. Chair, on that issue,
we'll vote here as I
appreciate that.
I indicated earlier that we'd recognize a couple of people, so I've kind of opened that up again. But Representative Westbrook, okay. You'll be the concluding one, and then we'll go to
the absent. What is the current absent policy? What's it been, Representative Slawick, and are we increasing it?
Well, right now there's a 25-day absent rule, Mr. Chair and Representative Westrom. This is in Minnesota Statutes, Chapter 119B.13. Child care providers may not be reimbursed for more than 25 absent days per child, excluding holidays, in a fiscal year, or for more than 10 consecutive absent days unless a child has a documented medical condition that causes more frequent absences. Documentation of medical conditions must be on the forms and submitted according to the timeliness established by the commissioner. So what this does, it allows, again, if the parent has a medical condition, it allows some flexibility in that. When you go past the 25 days, the child care provider is not reimbursed for any subsequent missed days. So what happens is for child care providers, for them to take on kids that are on subsidized care, is they often are losing money or not able to keep up. And so there's almost a disincentive to take on a family that participates in this in the basic sliding fee program.
So, Mr. Chair, and this issue, I mean, I would be cautious that we open up the absent. I mean, just the fact that government would be subsidizing somebody and paying for non-care is kind of like paying farmers not to plant their fields. I mean, that the taxpayers don't really like those types of programs, so it might be something we need to tighten up in the future.
Representative Pepper.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Slawick. I wanted to go back to some of my earlier questions on the child care assistance, and again, forgive me because I'm not an expert in this area by any means, or I'm not on the committee. I'm wondering, we've had a lot of talk about closing the achievement gap, and I'm wondering, are there requirements for these providers that they have certain requirements that make them ready for kindergarten? Because I was just looking in your bill, page 6, and it's kind of vague as to what exactly what can qualify as child care assistance. Can it be an in-home provider? Or are there any, I guess my concern is that if we are indeed giving money so that people can get off of welfare, I think that's great. But what assurances do we have that the children, once they go through these providers, are going to be ready for school?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, actually you're pointing out one of the things that we're all trying to struggle with. That's why you're seeing programs like the scholarship program come out where it's trying to increase quality care. They don't, as families receive the monies from the government, they don't necessarily have to go to a certified quality program because we don't have any sort of mechanism that measures things except licensing in our state. And that's why you're seeing we're trying to develop a quality rating system. We're trying to put things in place like the scholarship system because the monies would flow then to a certified quality provider, but we haven't figured out a certification system yet. So right now, no, there is no way of measuring the quality of where the children are going.
Thank you.
Okay, with that indicated, you could make any concluding comments before we vote to lay it over for future inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. We've had a good, spirited discussion here today, and I think that it's important to remember this bill passed 12-1 on a bipartisan basis out of the last committee. I appreciate your discussion, your comments, and we hope that you will support the bill today. Thank you.
And so Representative Slawick renews her motion that House File 1056, the second committee engrossment, be laid over for possible inclusion and an omnibus bill, and that was as amended. So any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion
no.
Carried. We'll,
thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
We're going to skip over the Clark bill at this point and take up House File 648 by Representative Mahoney. Representative Mahoney, we have a Senate final before us, so if you would care to move the Senate final.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee. I move Senate File 167 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
That motion is before us, and just so everybody knows what's happening, and I think your intent is to amend the Senate file with House language.
That is
that'll
correct,
the,
Mr. Chair.
That'll be the next motion. So,
that is the next motion.
Representative Mahoney makes the motion. Any discussion? Hearing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carried. And Representative Mahoney, if you care to make your motion then to amend the Senate file.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move to delete the Senate language and insert the language in House File 648.
That motion is before us. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion carried. And Representative Mahoney, if you would describe the bill.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'll take your advice here. If you want
to... You have some author's amendments? Is that what...
I have a couple of author's amendments. Well, I can explain the bill first, whichever you prefer. The author's amendments probably need to go on.
Why don't we put the bill in the order that you'd like? So is your first amendment A3? Or
yes, that is the A3 amendment. That is what this amendment does is for the Ainsworth Lumber Company, it moves the, it basically requires that any unemployment collected by the by the people that are laid off at the Ainsworth Lumber Company, it be used as an experience rating against the Ainsworth Lumber Company.
Okay, that amendment is before us. Any discussion? Hearing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, motion carried. I also have an A4 amendment. Is that an author's amendment as well? To get it in the order that you'd like?
Mr. Chair, it is an author's amendment. What this amendment does is this is the Northwest Mechanics Amendment. When they were first locked out, they filed for unemployment as is required, and often what happened was that and the people at the unemployment office who were following the rules as established, they were told that they were not eligible. So members quit calling in on a bi-monthly basis, and which at that point disqualified them. This bill requalifies them, qualifies all the mechanics for unemployment as the judge declared. I don't know the exact date. And then there's extra benefits in here in section 3 through 4. I believe it's up to 26 weeks. So they would get up to a year's worth of benefits, Mr. Chair and committee.
Okay, the amendment is before us then. Any discussion? Hearing none.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney moves the amendment H.O. 64884, and Representative Seifert.
Mr. Chair, this is a pretty significant change. I'm wondering how much is this going to cost? And it's a pretty significant expansion of what traditionally has been allowed for benefits. Is there someone who could answer that before I vote on it? I mean, this isn't the Labor Committee. I'd at least like to minimally know what this is going to cost if all the eligible employees take advantage of a year's worth of benefits.
Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, I've been informed that it's approximately $20 million, but if Mr. Nelson is in the audience, I'm sure he can give us a much closer dollar figure.
And a question of Mr. Nelson and by Representative Seifert, I assume. Is he here?
I believe he is, Mr. Chair.
And Mr. Nelson, if you could identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I am Lee Nelson. I am the Director of Legal Affairs for the Unemployment Insurance Program. Mr. Chairman, Representative Seifert, to your question, that's a difficult thing to say. Under this bill, under this amendment as it's currently drafted, there are 1,974 individuals who might be entitled. Now, how much they would collect is going to be from about zero to up until that additional 26 weeks. This is just to the extension portion. Under this bill as currently written, an individual could become unemployed tomorrow, next week, and get part of this extension. So how many of those 1,974 individuals are unemployed today? We don't know. How many may become unemployed, if they're even working today, how many will become unemployed tomorrow, next week, next month? We don't know. You know, that's a very, very difficult number to come up with. The maximum amount is up on, as Representative Mahoney indicated, up in the $20 million plus range. It's going to be substantially less than that. But it's almost a guess at this point because we don't even know who they are. But it is 1,974 people have the possibility of collecting under this somewhere between zero and about $13,600 apiece.
Representative Seifert, are you
Mr. Chair, I'm just absorbing that information, and I, you know, is this something, didn't the strike take place when people knew what the benefit structure was and what the laws were? Are we now, after people make the decision, we're going to come in and all of a sudden change legislation quickly to accommodate a decision that was made knowing what the collective bargaining obviously is done where people know what the consequences are when you do it. Is this the new trend now, is we're going to just throw out extra benefits if decisions are made that maybe aren't working out for one side or the other? I mean, this is a pretty big change, I think, more than what members are, I mean, maybe I'm the only one asking the question here, but this is a pretty big change in policy considering how much money this is going to cost and who it's going to affect. We're really kind of starting a precedent here. The business community, I'm sure, would like to say something. I don't know if they're allowed to, being that this hasn't really been heard before, but maybe nobody's here to say anything other than myself.
Representative Mahoney.
Was there a question in there?
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess, was this heard in committee, Representative Mahoney, in the Labor Committee?
Yes, it was.
Okay, and Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, why wasn't it incorporated in the bill in your committee? Or who? Or maybe it's, is it your committee or is it Representative Daveney's committee?
It would be Representative Rukavina. It was heard in Representative Rukavina's committee, the Higher Ed and Workforce Development Committee. It is traveling. Representative Rukavina thought it was not the correct place in his omnibus bill, but onto this unemployment insurance bill. So it's being taken out of his omnibus bill and put onto this particular bill.
Okay. That helps, Mr. Chair. I'm done.
Okay. And just to clarify, then, it was heard, and was it at one time in his bill?
It was heard, and I'm being corrected by Mr. Nelson here that it was not in his omnibus bill, but that was the intent. That out to a certain point, his omnibus bill has not been. Well, yes, it was presented, but
okay, but
it's not in there now.
But it did have a hearing. Okay,
yes.
That's the point then that Representative Seifert was interested in finding out. And Representative Sviga.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, sir. Usually when, I'm trying to remember here, when we extend unemployment benefits for certain groups, I know we've extended at certain times an additional 26 weeks of unemployment benefits.
Mr. Chair, could Representative Swiggin pull the microphone down because I can't hear him.
Usually we do it at such a time when the unemployment rate is fairly high or we have some type of a depression or entering into some type of a work slowdown within the country. Is that normally not the situation when the legislature's got involved in extended unemployment benefits? Sir?
Mr. Nelson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Swiggum, go through the whole history of the special extensions goes all the way back to about 1987. There have been about 15 of them. The last one took place in 2002, involved Finger Hut, but only at its outstate locations, involved Farmland Foods at its location somewhere down in southern Minnesota, and did involve airline industries as a direct result of 9/11. Prior to that, in 2001, there was a special extension. That extension was for 13 weeks. The only extension which has ever been this big, and this is actually broader than any extension which has ever existed before, involved LTV in 2001. That was a 26-week extension. That required the individuals to be in training. But you're right, Representative Swiggum, there were some specific findings that you were looking at an area of the state which had higher unemployment than average. You're looking at a community which was substantially impacted by that plant closure. And again, that was a little bit different, required the individuals to be in training. This bill does not require any training component. So that's the only one which involved 26 weeks.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, and then one more question, if I could. Representative Mahoney, as I'm going back to the last amendment that we've already added on the bill, can you recollect for me what you said again as you explained the amendment as we were seeking it here? Did you say something about the experience rating of the company, of the lumber company itself?
Correct, Mr. Chair.
Representative Swiggum.
with the Ainsworth Lumber Company, these unemployment benefits will be used in their ratings, experience rating, which is the way they figure their premiums.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, and I know I was seeking for the amendment, and I didn't hear everything you said, or I'm sure there were things I missed, but I think I heard you state exactly what you did now about the experience rating of the company. I'm not sure that you mentioned that the amendment was an extension of unemployment benefits. I don't know. I go back to the tape. You probably did mention it. No, missed me.
You're right. I did not.
Isn't that the nuts and bolts of the bill, Mr. Mahoney, or the amendment?
I think, telling Mr. Chair and Representative Swigum, I think the nuts and bolts is requiring them to use the experience rating, but somebody else can have a different opinion, but you're correct. It does bring forth 13 extra weeks of benefits.
Well, Representative Swigum.
Mr. Chairman, I guess it's probably my fault for not getting the amendment quickly before me and reading it. As I'm reading it after the fact, I was trying to listen to the words that you stated as we were trying to get the amendment. But obviously, at least from my perception, Mr. Mahoney, you either tremendously undersold the amendment or did not tell us exactly what was in it from what I consider to be the important policy change and the important policy direction of the amendment. Mr. Chairman, if I had the opportunity to go back and vote no on that amendment, I certainly would, as I will on this one that's before us.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
Representative Swigum, you have some valid points there, and I apologize for that. This is an amendment that has gone through a couple of committees, has the agreement of the department. The only substance of change to this amendment, as it was explained in the other committees, was the fact that the experience rating has changed. So I apologize if I did not explain it as well as I should have. But you are correct. It has the experience rating change. It has the extension of the unemployment benefits for an extra 13 weeks. And I apologize if I did not explain it in depth enough.
Representative Solberg.
Mr. Chairman, I know we're not on A3 anymore, but let me also, if we get the latitude to explain something in that, Representative Swigum, this is probably what I would think is the biggest change that we need to have is the extension of benefits. As you know, the housing market, the oriented strand board market is extremely soft. We're trying our best to do things in the legislative process, working with the governor, this task force on wood products that he formed when this was announced, their closings, that we're able to try our best to save the wood products industry in northeastern Minnesota. It's 135 jobs that have lost right now, and some of them are in training for temporary jobs, but there's, if you look at the need for an extension, and when we mention LTV steel, that the economy is depressed in that area at the time, that same thing is true with the Ainsworth situation in the Grand Rapids area. I know we're not debating this bill, but I extremely am appreciative of the extension for those families up there.
Okay, so let's see, we have Representative Anderson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Mahoney. The cost of this, I guess it was already mentioned, 135 jobs are affected by this. What's the cost of that, of this extension of benefits to your bill? And how many other lumber companies will be affected by this to the point that they would come forward and want to be asking for the same type of opportunity?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'll try to answer your question. the Ainsworth Amendment is on at present time. I don't know. I have no idea how many other lumber companies may or may not be affected by this. None have come forward that I know of. So I can't give you a better answer. I suspect Mr. Nelson is passing me a note that says it's about $250,000.
And Mr. Chair,
Sam Anderson,
on the A4 amendment, we're extending the extra benefits for the up to $20 million for the that extension. Is there a major? Is this going to create a problem in the balancing of your bill?
I'm sorry, is there
is this going to create a problem by adding this on and balancing out your bill or balancing out the budget?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, the unemployment fund is solvent, does not seem to create a significant problem in it. It does set a precedent, and that is something that it's not in the Senate bill at this particular time, and if it goes forward, we'll have to work it out in conference committee.
Oh, Mr. Chair, I just see this as you said, a precedent-setting circumstance, and I'm just kind of concerned that we didn't get a chance to discuss it completely in committee.
Mr. Chair,
Representative
Anderson, Representative Anderson, it does not set a precedent with the Ainsworth Lumber Company. If you're on that particular amendment,
no, I'm talking about the
on
A4.
The A4. We are discussing it. It does set a precedent. I've had a number of conversations. I have a little discomfort with it, but I'm at this particular point want to talk a little bit more about it. And if it passes at this particular point, we'll have to deal with it in conference committee with the Senate.
Thank you.
Any further discussion on the amendment? Hearing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion carried. There's another amendment here, 611. Is that yours, Representative Mahoney?
At this particular time, that has been incorporated into the First Amendment, the A3 Amendment, so it does not need to be offered.
Okay, so if you could go over the bill for us, but before you start, as I mentioned at the beginning of the meeting, our time schedule changed a bit when the decision was made that the House would go in at 11:30, and so I'm going to just announce for the benefit of those that are here for House File 2241 by Representative Clark that we will not be hearing that division report this morning. We'll do that after the spring break, but we will continue and get as far down some of the rest of the bills on the agenda until about 11:15 to give members a chance to get over to the floor session. So, Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm going to ask Mr. Nelson to stay at the table here, but I will explain the highlights of 648. The first article, Article 1, pages 2 to 19, is probably the guts of the bill. It provides for an alternative base period because we have it provides for an applicant who quits employment because of child care problems is not disqualified from collecting benefits. It reduces the state's average weekly wage calculation maximum weekly benefits but freezes it for 2 years, and the calculation at 351, which is the current level, increases the penalty on all fraud payments, puts a 5% recovery overpayment in the UI administration account from overpayment penalties. It changes the date of the annual adjustment in the state's maximum weekly benefit amount from the first Sunday in August to the last Sunday in October. Treats holiday pay as a deductible earnings, making it partially deductible rather than currently 100% deductible. Eliminates the protest process that is on most tax matters, providing for a direct appeal of all tax determinations, changes the tourist and recreation industry ineligibility provision to a non-charge provision on the employer's experience rating, makes all employers pay taxes quarterly along with certainly currently required quarterly filings of wage details rather than allowing small employers to pay annually, allows an unemployment law judge the discretion to dismiss an appeal if the appealing party does not participate in the evidentiary hearing. Then we get into Article 2, changes the part-time earning deductibility to 55% of the part-time earnings with no deduction for military earnings, changes the appeal period from 30 days on everything but the review by the Court of Appeals from the current 30 days to 20 days, eliminates all non-fraud overpayment determinations as separate documents and requires the monetary ineligibility and disqualification determinations and appeals decisions incorporating the resulting overpayments, makes the assessment of interest on fraud overpayment mandatory, increases from 10 years to 15 years the period of fraud overpayment balance may be collected before automatically canceling, and requires the threshold for employees that must pay tax electronically from 500 to 50 employees. The Article 3 is housekeeping. Article 4 incorporates the longstanding administrative rules into statute dealing with definitions of wages and employees' responsibility and termination. Article 5 changes the term disqualification or similar terms to ineligibility. And Article 6 is style changes to conform to revised statute. And that's the bill. This is a bill that went through all committees last year and did not get moved on the House floor for a variety of reasons, passed in the Senate last year. Hopefully we can get it through this year.
Representative Seifert. Mr. Chair, I just have two questions. Right next to each other, pages 18 and 19 on the bill, the maximum weekly benefit amount says high quarter calculation is 351. Representative Mahoney, do you know what it is now? Or the testifier?
351 is the current.
Okay. Is it just a recodification, basically? Or?
Mr. Nelson. It is not.
Okay. Okay, Mr. Chair, the second question on page 19, it says payments by electronic payment required, and the old system was every employer that reports 500 or more employees in any calendar quarter on wage detail report required under Section 268 must make payments due by electronic payment, and that changes it from 500 to 50. And I know I have small businesses in my district that are not going to like this. Maybe the department came up with this idea or the governor, I don't know who, but moving it down by a threshold of 90% isn't, for a small business person out in my district that's got 55 employees or whatnot, they may not be wild about doing the whole electronic payment thing. Could I get a rationale on that one? And is this something you feel very passionate about, Representative Mahoney, or could we be flexible on that one?
Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, there is, on page 20, the commissioner has the discretion, it's on line 20.4 and 20.5, to accept payments by other means. This is the electronic age. Do I feel passionate about the unemployment and insurance bill? No, I feel passionate about many other particular issues, but I think it is a smart idea for us as a state to move into the electronic age. Most small businesses even are doing electronic banking. There are a few that are not, but by and large, that's what we're going to, and it's an efficiency issue for the department.
Mr. Chairman, I guess if we have the allowance for allowing them to pay by other means, I understand that, but we're still giving government the right to say too bad to a small business that perhaps isn't in the electronic age out in my district where a lot of the small business people, Representative Otremba's got some out there, I'm sure, that maybe don't have all of the high-tech stuff that they should have, but is that for the government to decide, or is that for the small businessmen to decide whether they want to pay it or not? I think 500 is perhaps a high threshold for employees, that they're no doubt in my mind that they're going to have the computer technology, and I don't know if this is part-time or full-time employees, Representative Mahoney, but to me, that 50 threshold for a small business, and I don't, NFIB I don't think is in the room, but that seems to be a dramatic drop for the number of employee threshold, and I think I'd like to see that higher, and I don't have an arbitrary number in mind. I simply could move to strike the section and see if we can figure something out later, but we had a bill one time Senator Marty was trying to push that said we all had to file our campaign finance reports electronically. And we had howls of outrage from people that said, I like to do it the old way. My treasurer is a volunteer, et cetera, et cetera. Now, I understand when it's the legislature, we all stand up on our hind legs and say, no way. But if it's some business guy back home, we say, well, too bad. Get into the 21st century. That's not fair. And so I guess I'm going to move to strike Section 2 on page 19, Mr. Chair. If people think that this is a passionate issue, that we have to force these businesses to do this, the same argument was given to the Campaign Finance Board, said this will make things more efficient for the Campaign Finance Board, and the legislature said, too bad. We want to be humane to people who have to live by government requirements. The government requires these forms. We can at least try to be somewhat humane in making them, giving them a choice of whether they want to do it the old way or whether they want to do it computer-wise. And if we want to do it down the road, fine, but I guess right now, maybe someone's got an arbitrary number in mind, but to me, going down to 50 is awfully low for some of our small business people, particularly with part-time employees in rural Minnesota. I don't see it as a partisan issue. I just see it as, let's try to at least be humane in what we're doing here, since I don't see NFIB in the room.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Seifert, just so we clarify what the amendment is, then you said you want to move to strike Section 2 on page 19.
And the top of page 20.
And then you want to go through, I assume, line 20.5 on the top of page 20.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, just go back to current law and give people the choice. Well, if you have a business that has 55 employees and they want to pay it electronically, they have the right to do that now. I think that's great, but to force a dramatic 90% downward application for the small businessmen in rural Minnesota is a little bit too much.
Yeah, I understand you. I just wanted to clarify sections you were striking there. I had assumed you were going over to the top of page 20, but...
Yep.
And that is through, I'm reminded, that line 20.6, we would be striking through the effective date line there as well. Representative Sertich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I know Representative Mahoney may not care passionately about the UI bill, but I do, only because I sat on, for the last 6 years, the UI Advisory Task Force, along with Bob Gunther and Representative Seifert. NFIB may not be in the room right now, but they certainly were in the room during every task force meeting. The UI task force, advisory task force, has individuals represented from NFIB, Chamber of Commerce, actually individual small businesses with a geographical balance sit on that task force, and on the other side of the issue, individuals from labor organizations and other organizations that deal with UI matters. This issue has been debated and discussed for the last 4 years in that advisory task force, and came to this number after much discussion with the NFIB, with the State Chamber of Commerce, and others. And I believe and am comfortable in sitting through many hours of discussion on this and other issues in this bill, and the business community that has been involved for the last 4 years in this issue. We're comfortable with this number, with including the flexibility that is in the bill as well. And I believe sometimes when the business community is involved and other organizations and they come to this conclusion, we should leave well enough alone.
Any further discussion on the Seifert Amendment? I saw a hand going up to my right. Was it Representative Swiggan?
Mr. Chairman, I think it would be the Seifert Amendment, and I'm trying to understand the process. Representative Mahoney, if I may here. The entire bill we have before us at that you brought before us before the amendments is a recommendation of the Unemployment Benefit Council, the Unemployment Insurance Council that Representative Schurter and others served on. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair and Representative Swigum, yes.
Okay, because I see that there are both benefit increases and changes of wage history, changes in the state's average weekly wage. There's a give and a take, as I understand. So the bill, as it came forward into the committee, is the recommendation of this compensation council.
Mr. Chair and Representative Swigum, yes, it is the product of significant give and take by both large business, small business, labor. It also is cost neutral as it came to the committee. The two amendments have changed that, but as it says here, as it sits, it is a negotiated bill by all parties. And as to Representative Seifert's amendment, you know, if I can do my electronic banking, most small business men and women should be able to do it too. Most small banks, in, whether it's a small town of 600 or a town of 600,000, a banker is more than happy to do it electronically. It saves the state thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars to do it electronically, and it would save the small town banker and the business person thousands of dollars.
Mr. Chairman, to that point then, Representative Mahoney, I believe we should oppose the Seifert amendment. I believe that the bill before us is a negotiation of the advisory council. There is some give and take regarding the calculations of the statewide average weekly wage, the wage history. I think maybe to be more fair to those who use and need and the system is there for the help of those individuals. But let me also say that I think that the advisory council recommendation has been completely destroyed by the two amendments that we added previously as well. So I think the Seifert amendment should be defeated, and as the bill sits right now, I think it should also be defeated unless those two amendments get taken off.
Do we have the Seifert?
Mr. Chair, I'll just withdraw the amendment. Representative Swigum's right. The bill is flawed with the two amendments that got put on there, so it's no sense in beating a dead horse.
Okay, the amendment is withdrawn. Any further discussion on the bill? Representative Otremba, I guess, is on the list, and then Representative Westrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a little bit to what we were talking in Article 2. Does FACS, are they considered electronic?
I'm sorry, Representative Otremba, I didn't hear you.
Are FACSs considered electronic?
I don't think you can fax a check, but so I don't think so.
Representative Trimba.
Mr. Chair, and maybe this is just a statement, but we do have a lot of analog people still in the rural areas. Many businesses are located outside of a city, and I still do analog, and it is really it's a slow process. In that process, I lose my data, so I'm constantly saving and moving. So I don't know if anybody has any thoughts about some of those kinds of technical audit.
Are you looking for a question? I think what it really says is that we need to wire the whole state, Representative Otremba.
Mr. Chair, I'm all for that. But in the meantime, is there some sort of waiver for somebody who has 51 employees and it's analog and it's very time consuming?
Mr. Chair and Representative Otremba, it does, the bill does allow the commissioner to waive the requirement. I'm sure businessmen and women in the state of Minnesota are very apt at change. I don't think this is going to create much of a problem. And worst case scenario, it's just a phone call to the bank to say release the funds and electronically transfer them. But yes, there is a way for the small businesses to under 500 and over 50 to get out of the electronic transfer business if that's what they choose to do.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm sure if they had a faster speed internet, it would be a lot easier, but I'm glad to hear that there are waivers for those until we get broadband internet in some of our rural
areas. I think it should be a priority of the state to get a broadband across this whole state.
Representative Westrom.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Representative Mahoney, just to that point of Representative Otrembas, glad to hear there's a waiver. Maybe some language you could consider for the future would be that notice to a business needs to be given that a waiver is possible, because I often deal with constituents or businesses and there's a regulation in place and that's all they're ever made aware of. And in fact, my whole involvement, and I'm sure you've had the same situations and other members as well, if the deputy commissioner or the supervisor or the people in charge that are regulating the businesses would have made them aware of that waiver process up front, they could have maybe avoided a whole lot of time for everybody, including calling me and or you and others to go back to the commissioner or the deputy commissioners and figure out that, in fact, the department could have dealt with this. And so sometimes the departments, while they have that ability, they don't make people aware of it, and until they've spent many days and hours on stuff. So I would just encourage you to maybe, while we're amending this bill anyways, seemingly, maybe that would be a very easy word change, some words that just says they have to give businesses in this category the notice. But the question I had, Representative Mahoney, on, in addition to that, would be, you talked about changing the appeal from 30 to 20 days. What exactly is that changing?
Representative Mahoney.
Well, the appeals process, it just shortens it. We now have one of the longest in the nation, as I understand, and this shortens it and requires, just shortens it.
So, Mr. Chair, shortens what? The process of the applicant filing for initial unemployment or the hearing that goes on by telephone and then that's denied and then that's appealed to the Court of Appeals? Or actually, it's appealed to an employment law judge first, and then it goes to the Court of Appeals, if I recall the process of unemployment appeals. Which part's being shortened?
It's, Mr. Chair and Representative Weston, it is changing the appeals process, or when it's been denied, when you go and apply for unemployment and your employer appeals it, they generally have 30 days to respond. And all of that time, you don't get unemployment. This shortens that time to 20 days versus 30 days. Again, still longer than almost any other state in the nation. It does not affect the Court of Appeals.
So, Mr. Chair, on this issue,
Representative Westrom,
you said if the employer appeals it, what about if the employee's benefits have been denied and he or she appeals it? Is it the same for him or her, the employee as the employer?
Mr. Chair,
Mahoney.
Representative Westrom, yes.
So,
Representative Westrom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, I would urge us maybe not to do that. 20 days is less than 3 weeks. And if somebody's been denied, business is trying to appeal or an individual, just the process of maybe they haven't engaged an attorney up front. And I can speak to a case specifically in this arena. By the time they go to an attorney, talk to them, and get them up to speed on the case, 3 weeks may tick by faster than they can get all that done. So I would just encourage you to maybe reconsider that. Less than 3 weeks is not very long.
Mr. Chair,
Representative
Western, For 30 years, we had it 7 days. And they went to 30. And time again, the employee who has been denied benefits is the one who suffers. I will not consider going less than or going more than 20 days. I think it's an affront to unemployed people who are appealing. You know, if you're saying that people are too incompetent to get an attorney within 3 weeks, I would beg to differ. I think most people are. I really would love to see us go back to 7 days. I mean, I think the state should be able to be that efficient. I think the employers, if they appeal, should be that efficient. And I think the employees, if they are appealing, should be that efficient. These are benefits that people have, the employers have paid out, and benefits that the employee has earned. And I think we should just make sure that they get them if they are deserving of them.
Okay, with that, I think, Mr. Chair,
if I could just ask another question here on the bill. Can you explain this alternative base period provision and how that works?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to turn that one over to Mr. Nelson right now.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, it's fairly complex, but let me try to give it a shot real quick. There are about 17 states which currently have this. Right now, if you applied for unemployment benefits today, we would look at the period October 1st of 05 through September 30th of 06, your base period, so your last over five months of work would not be considered. What this says is if you don't qualify in that original base period, we're going to look at the most recent completed quarter in addition, that quarter from October 1st through December 31st. We'll consider those wages to determine if you qualify. We assume the estimate is about 2,400 people will, in fact, collect benefits who are currently denied. They've worked a long time, could work up to 6 months and not be able to collect. And this simply says if they don't meet the time period, if they don't fall in the correct time period, we'll look at a little different time period to determine if you qualify for benefits. And again, the overall bill is cost neutral, and that takes this into account.
Representative Keeson, is that?
Yeah, well, Mr. Chair, so that provision, that's worked out pretty well in these other states that they've done it.
No. Mr. Chairman, this is done automatic in Minnesota. I mean, once we get our, if this bill passes, is signed, it's simply automatic. You file, and if you don't, you come up zeros on the original base period. This one will automatically be looked at to see if you come up and qualify. So other states do it differently. Other states impose requirements on employers. This imposes no requirements on employers.
Okay, with that, Representative Mahoney renews his motion that Senate File 167 be recommended to pass as amended and re-refer to the Committee on Ways and Means. Any further discussion? Hearing none, then, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion carried.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney, thank you. Representative Keeson, I understand that you would be willing to take care of, on Representative Huntley's behalf, House File 1078. My question is that controversial at all in terms of we want to be out of here in the next 5 minutes or so due to floor session?
Mr. Chair, I think it's going to take longer than 5 minutes to do, to go through the bill.
Okay.
Mr. Chair? Representative Peace and I, are you aware of something? As far as I know, this bill has peace in the valley. I think the two sides have signed off on it. I know I'm happy with the language of the bill, and I think it would be important for this bill to move so that we can make sure it doesn't affect the bond rating for the Maple Grove Hospital.
Well, and Mr. Chair, just to explain a little bit, some of this bill has been put into the omnibus, Representative Huntley's omnibus bill. Portions of these provisions. Other provisions have been moving as it's moved through the process. We did hear this in policy committee, and it was actually a fairly controversial provisions. I understand progress has been made, but, you know, that was done in Representative Huntley's committee, and I think it would make sense to have Representative Huntley here at the very least to talk about that, because I was not in that committee session.
And I had gotten the message that you might be willing. But the in terms of when we could take it up on the floor, what we can do is have this bill before us very early when we get back. We'll be in session. This committee will be in session on Tuesday when we get back. And I think as a practical matter, we may be talking about a relatively short period of time relative to committee action the floor time.
And, Mr. Chair, I think that's appropriate. We do need to move it, but I would feel more comfortable if Representative Huntley is here.
With that, you're being requested to please leave your handouts behind. The staff will pick them up. Yeah, it'd probably be helpful if you just put them in your packets then. And with that, our session starting in just a little bit. Meeting adjourned.